Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Even as we wait for election results, the pandemic is ravaging the nation, and the number of infections is up. Emergency rooms and intensive care units are filling. The death toll is climbing. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has been following that. And, Rob, I've described a very grim situation here. Can you give us an update, more details on what's happening?
Yeah, you know, Audie, every time we talk about the pandemic, the picture just looks worse, unfortunately. More than 9 million people in the United States have now caught the virus. And if you look at the map of the country, the virus is surging and setting records from coast to coast. It's rebounding in parts of the Northeast that had beaten it back, and it's rising again across the South, and just absolutely pummeling the Midwest and shooting up out in places in the West. So, you know, more than 100,000 new infections were reported in a single day for the first time this past week. But that record, it was immediately eclipsed the next day when more than 121,000 more people were reported infected. I talked again today about this with Dr. Tom Frieden. He used to run the CDC.
Throughout much of the country, you have really big increases, doubling and tripling of cases. It's entered the exponential phase, and that means it's going to get worse and, frankly, a lot worse before it gets better.
And, you know, based on the current trajectory, the average daily case count could easily soon double again.
So the spread of the virus is appearing to accelerate in many parts of the country. What does this mean for hospitalizations?
You know, we're seeing hospitals being pushed to the limit around the country. More than 53,000 COVID-19 patients are already hospitalized. Intensive care units are reaching capacity in some places. And that's really scary because it could be getting to the point where the medical system just won't be able to keep up. In fact, the Pentagon is deploying 3 medical teams to El Paso, Texas, to help out there because things are so bad. And Wisconsin is in really tough shape. And we can't forget, more than 235,000 Americans have already died from COVID, and more than 1,200 are dying in a single day now. Dr. Frieden says all this couldn't be happening at a worse time with the winter and the flu season looming.
This is a terrible time. The confluence of factors here is extremely problematic. We're heading into holiday season when there'll be more people getting together, more people traveling, and more cold weather, so harder for people to socialize out of doors. This is a very dangerous time.
What are the health officials saying about what can be done to beat this back?
Well, you know, it's definitely not too late to fight back. We do know what can slow the virus down, and it's nothing surprising, you know, wearing masks and staying away from other people as much as possible, especially when we're indoors. Some states are rolling back their reopening plans in response to all this, or, you know, imposing new restrictions like restricting indoor dining at bars and restaurants and requiring more mask wearing. But others are still resisting taking those kinds of steps, even if they're being really slammed now. And it's hard because there's a lot of pandemic fatigue right now in the country. But if this doesn't happen, the death toll could really hit unimaginable levels in the coming weeks and months.
You know, Rob, despite these numbers, we had very high turnout in the national elections. What have you learned about the effect of the pandemic on this process?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. NPR crunched some numbers about this and found something that may sound surprising. Support for President Trump actually increased in many of the counties that had the highest death rates from COVID-19. Now, it's really hard to interpret that. It could be people in these places are really invested in the president's approach and are kind of doubling down to stick with it. Or, you know, or maybe the pandemic did hurt the president, that his support might have increased even more in these places if they hadn't suffered so much. We just don't know. So this is something that researchers are just starting to pick apart.
That's NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Thank you.
You bet.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Paul Tuck, thanks for joining us. You've written a lot about the things that matter most in education. When you look now at K-12 in the pandemic, what most concerns you?
Well, I'd say there's two things. I mean, one is I'm concerned for every student who is not able to go to school in person. One of the things that I wrote about in this book is that the environment that students are learning in matter a whole lot. Being able to form real connections with teachers and other educators matters. But I'm especially concerned about the divide, the fact that students who are growing up in adversity are right now much less likely to be in class and less likely to be having the kind of intensive, connected learning experiences that we know make such a difference for students.
That kind of equity divide involves both technology and home environment?
But absolutely, yeah. So there are students who are just not able to connect with their classes at all. They don't have Wi-Fi. They don't have computers. That is leading to considerable learning loss. But even when students are able to digitally connect, if they are doing remote learning and they're in an environment that is disorganized and loud and chaotic, which is certainly true for a lot of families, if they've got everybody at home right now, if they're, you know, housing insecure, all of those things take a real toll on students who are growing up in those environments.
Your research has focused on non-cognitive skills, so character development, building curiosity, building so-called grit. How do those things come into play now, especially in remote learning?
Well, I think in two ways. I mean, one thing that is clear from the reporting I did in Helping Children Succeed is that the most important fact in developing those sorts of qualities is the environment that children are growing up in. And when they're in environments with a lot of stress, it's a lot harder to develop those skills. So that's the one side. On the other hand, there's also the problem that if you're struggling with those skills, if you are in a stressful environment, it is harder to do remote learning. And if you're having a stressful year, like a lot of young people are, it's going to be really tough to focus enough to make remote learning work.
I want to ask you about higher education because it's what you've been writing about more recently. There we're seeing changes in terms of who's attending and who's not, for one thing.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are still pretty early right now, but what I'm seeing is distressing, that there does seem to be this growing divide, that enrollment is down at community colleges, it's down among students of color, and that runs the risk of really increasing the kinds of divides in college attainment that a lot of people thought were starting to narrow.
It's too early to tell, of course, with all of this, how it'll play out. But does your research, does your gut, in fact, tell you that this pandemic may have lasting impacts on American education?
I think it absolutely will. I think the learning loss that's happening this year and the inequities in that learning loss are going to take a while to overcome. But just as concerning is the financial side. So this is true both in K-12 education and in higher education. There are a lot of states that in this recession are going to be struggling with tax revenues. And often that means cuts in education. Higher education is often the first thing that's cut, but K-12 education as well. And that those cuts often fall disproportionately on the students who need help the most. So I think there's a real risk that this is going to linger for a long time.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation online. I'll ask you some of the questions our readers had. For now, Paul Tough, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've always said, listen, college football is king of the world.
This is KNKX. As the Pac-12 football season gets underway this weekend, the Saturday night game between the Washington Huskies and California Golden Bears has been canceled. A player for Cal tested positive for COVID-19, and several other players are being forced to isolate due to contact tracing protocols. KNKX sports commentator Art Thiel talked about all the unknowns surrounding the Huskies and the conference this year. Art, in this COVID-shortened, conference-only season, what do we know about how the Huskies look?
Well, that's a great mystery because no reporters have seen the Huskies in practice because of the COVID restrictions. And there's a new head coach. There's a new offensive coordinator. There's going to be a new starting quarterback. And they've also lost 10 players with eligibility remaining, 5 to the NFL and another 5 for various reasons, including COVID opt-outs. So this is really a hard team to read right now, as it is throughout the Pac-12. What we do know is that they're trying to choose among 4 quarterbacks to start the season. They've got a very seasoned guy, Kevin Thompson, a 7th-year collegian. He was out for 2 years with injuries from Sacramento State, where he transferred from. He's from Auburn Riverside High School. A redshirt sophomore, Jacob Sermon, from Bothell, a redshirt freshman, Dylan Morris, from Graham Kapausen in Pierce County, and a Newport Beach, California kid, freshman Ethan Garbers. All of these guys are very talented in different ways, but Coach Jimmy Lake refuses to name a starter. And he's being, you know, typically paranoid coach because he doesn't want to leak information that would be helpful to the opponents. I think it's going to be Kevin Thompson. He's the most experienced guy. He led a successful Sacramento State team for three seasons. And I think he's more likely to get them wins right now than the younger players. But again, that's a guess. We'll see what happens when the Husky season starts.
Well, you mentioned Jimmy Lake. He's been with the school for a while, but this is his first season as head coach.
Right. And that's always a mysterious thing because it's a whole lot different going from assistant to head coach in college because of so many more management responsibilities. And Lake seems to be navigating it okay, but we're not going to know until we see some games. He's been on the defensive side for 6 years, and this is his first chance around the offense. He really does have the enthusiastic support of a lot of his players, and I think he's going to bring more energy than Chris Peterson, his predecessor, who admitted to burning out in his last year at the Husky helm. So I think there's going to be an uptick there, but how it manifests exactly on the field remains to be seen.
So many factors at play here, raising so many questions. How do you think the Huskies are going to do this season?
Boy, this is such a hard read right now because the issue in the Pac-12 is COVID, not the other teams. It's really a strange year because normally the Pac-12 ends in November. It's starting this year. It's the last conference among the Power Five conferences to begin a season. And they're doing it in the face of a third wave of COVID-19 infections. We know we're starting to get even more infections in the Puget Sound area than we had in March. So this is a dangerous time to be starting up a season when we've also got the complication of the flu spreading around. And if they can get through, it's going to be a major feat. And who those two championship teams are a complete mystery to me and I think everyone in the league.
All right, Art. Thanks.
My pleasure.
KNKX sports commentator Art Teal's website is Sports Press Northwest at sportspressnw.com. And you can subscribe to podcasts of our weekly conversations at knkx.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kirsten Kendrick.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
That is showing a bad image for your school and for Northside as a whole.
Allegations of racial slurs at a high school here has one student speaking out. A student from Brandeis High School is accusing a group of O'Connor High School football players of launching a racial or racist attack on a student during a video chat session. News 4 San Antonio's Darian Trotter is working for you to find the reaction from the district.
Taunting and teasing a student at Brandeis High School. An alleged group of O'Connor High School football players are caught on camera launching a vicious racial attack.
And as you can hear in this video, they were intentionally coming after her because of the color of her skin and because of her race.
The young black woman recorded the FaceTime call allegedly showing the young men who called her the N-word. Sent messages that they hate all N-words.
Let's snatch your wee.
And that they were stupid monkeys.
Stupid.
Telling her, you're a monkey, you're this, you're that, because of the color of her skin.
We're protecting the... who is a friend of the alleged victim.
You're not funny.
He's angry and says varsity football players should be held to a higher standard. We've also blurred the video that's gone viral to protect identities.
The teachers could identify them, the coaches could identify them, and I'm pretty sure the principal could identify them.
School leaders at O'Connor are aware of the allegations and have identified one student in the video. They're investigating the situation that allegedly involves 11 students on the call.
No matter who said what, they all took a part in it.
This student has come forward because he says racial attacks have been an ongoing problem within the district, fueled, he says, by past remarks from President Donald Trump.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime. They're rapists.
It tells them that, you know what, if my president can do it, I can do it too.
In a statement, the district says Northside ISD does not tolerate racism in any form. Racial or derogatory slurs have no place in any setting in our district.
I just want the issue to be addressed. I want parents to be notified. I want these kids to be removed off the football team.
Darian Trotter, News 4, San Antonio.
The district also said campus administration investigates all allegations of racist or derogatory slurs when reported, and anybody who's aware of an issue that a district campus has not thoroughly been addressed, well, they are all urged to come forward.
Don't meet many Marines these days. Everybody joins the Navy.
Everybody joins the Navy.
A recent executive order by the Trump administration calls a halt to unconscious bias training within the military's ranks. Now, this comes at a time when a Navy task force is looking at longstanding discrimination. Despite the White House edict, that work continues. Steve Walsh with KPBS in San Diego has the story.
Force Master Chief Hubin Phillips puts it this way.
Throughout my 31 years, where I've seen racism or discrimination personally against me, I knew what the policy was, right? I knew that it was wrong. But when you're in a minority, you just kind of put your head down, right? You kind of figure out, you think about self-preservation, you think about your family, you think about the bigger picture.
Phillips is part of the One Navy Task Force, which is looking at how to end discrimination in the ranks. The problem starts at the top. Out of 268 admirals in the U.S. Navy, only 10 are African American. Most of them are rear admirals like Alvin Halsey, who is heading the task force.
That's pretty small.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Right now, there are no African American admirals at the two highest ranks. Building an admiral is a 20 to 30 year commitment, Halsey says. It's not just about test scores and performance reviews. Someone has to be willing to guide that young officer.
As a black officer in the Navy, I'll tell you that I've mentored more people that don't look like me than look like me. It's your mathematics, right? But I'll tell you also, because there's very few guys who've come before me in small numbers, someone who don't look like me had to reach out and engage and make a difference in my career.
African Americans make up 13% of the population, but less than 9% are naval officers. So the pipeline starts off small. Then, somewhere along the way, many people just become exhausted, says Keith Green, a lieutenant commander who retired in the 1990s. He recently wrote the book Black Officer, White Navy.
It is not simply just unconscious bias. There are active behaviors that are happening to people because they don't like working for a black person or a minority, and they don't like having, you know, one be their supervisor.
Green says the extra effort to work around racism takes its toll.
Not only do you have to do all the other stressful things that any military person has to do, you have to play that double game of trying to figure out why you're being treated differently or what's happening to you, or why is something happening to you that isn't happening to other people.
Retired Rear Admiral Sinclair Harris heads the National Naval Officers Association, which has worked for over 50 years to promote diversity in the sea services. He says it takes hundreds of ensigns to eventually make one admiral, or what the Navy calls a flag officer.
You got to bring more people in the beginning so that the quality cut that you're going to have, especially when you get to senior officer and get to flag officer, you have enough people in the pot.
Harris calls it Death Valley, that point where junior officers opt to end their careers. Graduating from the Naval Academy is the most well-worn path to admiral, but less than 6% of the current class at the Naval Academy is African American.
When you only have one out of 20 diverse candidates going up for flag officer in a certain community, and they decide, hey, you know what, I just got this high-paying job at IBM, guess what? Now you're down to zero, and you got to look through that pipeline, and that pipeline is anemic.
One Navy task force is scheduled to issue its report in December. It's unclear what concrete steps the Navy would then take to address decades of systemic racism. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
If I'm a slave, call me a slave. Don't tell me that I'm a free person and I'm still a slave. Yeah, that really lulls me to sleep. You're not really a slave, you know. You're a co-worker. You know, you're a member of the firm, you know. This is the Bodie Plantation.
One outcome we know from this election day, a name change for Rhode Island. It will no longer be known as, quote, the State of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. A ballot measure removes Providence Plantations.
That's right. A longtime proponent of the change, State Senator Harold Metz, says 10 years ago, Rhode Islanders voted to keep the phrase because
people didn't understand at the time how hurtful the word plantations are to people of African-American descent.
Professor Linford Fisher of Brown University says the phrase goes back to the state's earliest days.
The first time we see the use of Providence Plantations is in the 1643 charter.
Fisher says even if state founder Roger Williams did not use the word plantations to describe a large farm worked by enslaved people, it was the word already loaded with meaning.
So even if we want to say, well, it wasn't with regard to slavery, it has a strong settler colonial context of expanding and settling upon native lands.
But the link between plantation and slavery was a familiar one.
By that time, the Spanish had been spreading around different parts of Central and South America for 100, 125, 130 years. They are building their empire on the back of first indigenous, then African enslavement. This is no secret.
And the authors of the 1643 charter would soon demand their own enslaved people.
Within two or three years of coming to Rhode Island, Roger Williams himself requests a Pequot captive for his own servant or slave.
Rhode Island ended up being key in the transatlantic slave trade.
That means that we actually, as a state, participated directly in the very thing that this word has come to mean through the 18th and 19th century.
You know, it's only recently that people even understand the major role that Rhode Island had in slavery.
That is Lorraine Spears, executive director of the Tamaquag Museum in Exeter, Rhode Island.
She says even the name given to these plantation owners was stolen from the area's indigenous community.
Mind you, they appropriated our name to be the Narragansett Planters.
She says this was an act of erasure, and this week's ballot measure, she says, plays some small part in helping understand the bigger story.
The point is, you don't keep something that is oppressive to many, many people, and that is not fully telling the truth of the history.
I found it interesting that every single time it was, you know, the white person in the relationship who had this very sincere trust that the system would work for them, and always shocked when it didn't. At Clayton High School, I really loved writing films, and a professor told me that I maybe should think about this seriously as a career, and it really changed my life, you know. I mean, it's incredibly formative. On top of that, you know, driving back and forth from Clayton to West County every day, I had a fair share of my own interactions with police, which were never pleasant.
Shatara Michelle Ford's new film examines sexual assault by looking through the lens of a black woman in a relationship with a white man. The director acknowledges drawing on their relationship with a white British guy and growing up in St. Louis on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Sarah Fenske. This is St. Louis on the Air. If you've already watched everything on Netflix and you're sick of the election, the 29th annual Whitaker St. Louis International Film Fest is now underway. It offers a curated roster of movies you can stream from your couch, many of them with Missouri connections. One of those films is Test Pattern. It's a feature film that tackles a serious subject, a sexual assault on a young black woman that shakes her world and puts her relationship to the test. It's a gripping movie with first-rate performances. And joining us to talk about it is director Shatara Michelle Ford. Shatara, welcome.
Hi.
So this is your first feature film, and it's a very heavy film in many ways. What drew you to this topic?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to talk about consent. I wanted to have a deeper kind of nuanced analysis of the experiences of sexual assault, and I wanted to center black women, black femmes. I read a lot about rape kits not being tested, the backlog that I think we all know about. But the thing that shocked me the most and just kind of my deep research into this is the fact that rape kits themselves are really hard to come by in many places. And so you might go to a hospital and they might not know what you're talking about, or they might not have them in stock. You might go to an urgent care and they try to charge you, which they absolutely should not be doing. Or you might be someone who has experienced assault, rape, and don't even know that rape kits are a possibility, that a forensic exam is something that you could do if you wanted. And mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of go through that experience and have a deeper analysis of the kind of systemic problems that exist within navigating sexual assault and consent.
Well, I got to say, this was an eye-opener for me. I honestly had no idea that for a woman who would go to the emergency room and try to get a rape kit to gather evidence proving what happened to her, that these hospitals aren't ready to deal with that in many cases. I had no idea. I did a little research after watching this film. Sure enough, you're onto something here. But, you know, you're looking at these very serious issues, but it's also a very human film. We get to know these two characters. And we really get to know them in some nuanced ways. And this is an interracial couple. Did you base these two on anyone that you know, or were they people that you dreamed up?
Oh, well, you know, I think, first of all, I'm in an interracial relationship. I'm married to a white British guy, actually. Mm. And I think that, you know, we see eye to eye on many things. And I think he absolutely understands the experience that, you know, I have navigating life in America. But I think the one thing that really came up, and this is honestly around 2014 after Mike Brown was shot. I'm originally from St. Louis. I grew up there. I understand what it's like to be a black person in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. I think that, I don't know, I've always been very weird driving around the suburbs or driving around in areas that I'm not familiar with and engaging with police. And my partner understood that, I think, intellectually, but at times it kind of was always kind of not fully able to believe that the system might not work for me, or that I would have this mistrust of something if, you know, I needed support. And so that's kind of the little seedlings of how I was kind of examining how just location impacts how you trust the system, how your identity, your sexuality, your gender, your race impacts how you trust the system. And so I thought that there'd be really interesting conflicts between just a black or white man and a black woman wanting to explore the healthcare system and the justice system together. They're definitely going to come out on different sides on that. Mm-hmm. So that's what that came from. Also, you know, in the many stories that I heard, the research that I did, I came across interracial couples that were navigating something like this. And I found it interesting that every single time it was, you know, the white person in the relationship who had this very sincere trust that the system would work for them, and always shock when it didn't.
That is so interesting. And yeah, I don't want to give away anything that happens in this movie, but exploring sort of how that ends up being a fallacy, that's a big part of where this movie goes. Mm-hmm. I have to ask, though, you're talking about growing up in St. Louis, and clearly that shaped how you're approaching these issues. You ended up setting this film in Austin, Texas, and
it evokes Austin in such particular and subtle and smart ways. I used to live in Texas. I felt like I was in Texas when I was watching this film. I was actually shocked to find out, no, you don't live in Texas. You live in Philly after growing up in St. Louis. What made you decide to make this a Texas story?
Well, yeah, you know, first of all, if I could have said it in New Jersey, I absolutely would have. Mm-hmm. I think that as a first-time filmmaker, you are going to, for some independent filmmaker, I should say, you're going to make your project in a place where you have connections and access to resources. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, St. Louis was not a place where I could easily mount up the type of production that I wanted to quickly. Whereas I had spent time in Austin, I had quite a few friends in Austin, and Austin's an incredibly filmmaker-friendly city. Mm-hmm. And what also worked in my favor is that I was having a conversation about kind of race and class that I think actually mirrors St. Louis in a lot of ways. And so what I thought that it could be a very good kind of comp in a way. So I felt like the things that I experienced and that I was analyzing, having grown up in St. Louis, I could definitely, explore that in Austin as well, especially on the front of just like policies. I think that, you know, Texas has their own culture of some pretty strict and conservative reproductive access and bodily justice policies. And Missouri does too. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think we all know about, you know, the conflicts that surround Planned Parenthood being one thing. And so I thought that in those two ways, that was a really interesting dynamic that Missouri and Texas share.
These are liberal cities in red states, mm-hmm, setting it in
absolutely.
Austin. We're talking to Shatara Michelle Ford. Her film is Test Pattern. You can watch it at the St. Louis International Film Festival. I recommend watching it. Shatara, I want to know a little bit more about your background. I'm now super intrigued after talking to you and watching this film. I understand it isn't just that you grew up in St. Louis. You grew up in some of its largely white suburbs. You were in Clayton, and then your family, I understand, is still in Creve Coeur. What was that like?
I think it was completely formative in the way that I view the world. I think that coming from St. Louis, you are, no matter where you're from, I think you are someone who thinks about race a lot. You know, St. Louis is an incredibly segregated city, as well as our, you know, inner and outer ring suburbs. And I think that I had the unique experience of being a Black person, going to school in Clayton schools, but not being a part of the voluntary student transfer program. My family moved to St. Louis in 1988. I was a year old, and my dad was a teacher at Clayton schools, and that's what allowed me to go there. So I got to see a lot, being, you know, a lower middle class kid, you know, not from Clayton, but also not from the neighborhoods that were busing students in, I got to see a really, like, microcosm of kind of the class politics and racial politics that shaped St. Louis on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was hard. You know, I graduated in 2005. In 2004, you know, we asked really big questions about if we were going to continue the voluntary student transfer program. Mm-hmm. It didn't look like it was going to happen for a while. And we know that there have been lasting impacts of that decision from, you know, over 15 years ago now. I was heavily involved in, you know, questioning that, but I also recognized that, you know, Clayton absolutely had a problem with integration and like true parity, and, you know, racial justice and social justice work needed to be done. Mm-hmm. I think that even now, conversations about race in Clayton is not anywhere near where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. My younger brother graduated from Clayton, I believe in 2016. And, you know, he's still very, very, very active in challenging the Clayton School District to recognize, you know, some of its failings. Hmm. It's incredibly formative. On top of that, you know, driving back and forth from Clayton to West County every day, I had a fair share of my own interactions with police, which were never pleasant. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, yeah.
So I want to ask you one thing. I mean, I know you studied race and politics and sociology. This was at Pitzer College in California. It sounds like a great path to academia, being a college professor. What made you decide, I'm going to make an independent film instead at great cost and a ton of work. I want to go this route.
You know, I almost even got my PhD. It was like a very quick change, you know, a few years ago. I'd always loved movies, always. You know, my family were the ones who every Friday night, you know, we would go to West Olive 16 or Creve-Coeur 12, sometimes the Esquire, and see a film. Mm-hmm. And I never really thought this is something that I could actually do. And it wasn't until college, where I was, you know, studying political science and sociology, that I started taking a few screenwriting classes. I'd done a screenwriting independent study at Clayton High School. I really loved writing films. I thought, you know, I had some open time, I would try it again. And a professor told me that I maybe should think about this seriously as a career. Hmm. And it really changed my life, you know. So I got an MFA in the UK in screenwriting, and still was flirting with academia, and applied to, you know, PhD programs, and made a plan to move back to the U.S. and do that. And at the last minute, I was just kind of like, you know what? I think I should actually take this seriously. I think what I actually want to be is a director. And so, you know, I moved to Los Angeles 8 years ago and started down that path.
And here today is the result of all that labor. That is Test Pattern. It's a great movie. It's part of the St. Louis International Film Festival. That runs now through November 22nd. And you can screen all of these films from your couch. Go to cinemastlouis.org for more information. It costs just $10 to see this movie that we're talking about. And once you buy it, you have until November 22nd to watch it. So, Shatara, Michelle Ford, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You got more questions, but I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
With the end of campaign season, we're going to hear a lot of conversation about the Latino vote or the black vote. What you won't hear a lot about is the white vote. So I asked Gene Demby from NPR's Code Switch podcast team to come on the program and talk about why.
So the white vote is always there, but, you know, we in the media have a million euphemisms for the white vote. We have a lot of ways to say white without saying white. We say evangelical, soccer moms, suburban women, NASCAR dads, etc. Never mind that, you know, plenty of people of color over-index on things like church attendance, or that, you know, the suburbs all over the country are becoming browner all the time. White is kind of implied in U.S. politics, and because it's left implied, there tends to be this hyper-focus after elections on the way that non-white voters behave. So right now we're hearing a lot about Biden's underperformance among Latino voters in Florida, for example, but far less about the fact that Trump won 60% of white voters in Florida. And white voters make up nearly 2/3 of the electorate in Florida this year, at least according to the New York Times. So Trump's viability relies almost entirely on his consistently strong white support. But because we don't talk about white people that way, we tend to focus on these sort of marginal shifts with people of color.
So what is the story that the media tends to tell? I mean, is it really looking at the white vote as somehow a cohesive voting bloc?
Well, I mean, white voters on the top line are not a bloc in the way that black voters are. Black voters regularly vote for Democrats somewhere like in the mid-80s into the mid-90s in terms of percentages in presidential elections. And it's true that a solid majority of white voters break one way. The majority of white voters have voted for Republicans in presidential elections going back to the 1960s. Lyndon Johnson was actually the last Democrat to win the white vote. But it's when you get under the hood that you start to see what looks more like block voting. So white evangelicals, for example, they overwhelmingly support Trump in numbers that look like block voting. Another big part of the Republican base is non-college educated whites. So Trump won almost 2/3 of white voters without college degrees in 2016. And it appears, it's early, but it appears he won them again pretty handily this time. Trump also narrowly won most white voters with college degrees that time. But this year, support seems to be about even. White men broke for Trump pretty comfortably in 2016. And Trump famously, or infamously, depending on what your Twitter feed looks like, Audie, won white women in 2016, too. And again, there's some indication that Trump may have done even better with white women this time around. And that's a shift that's worth keeping an eye on as the election data becomes clearer. But when it comes to swaths of white voters, we're really talking about how big the majorities of support for Republicans go in presidential elections, not whether they'll have the majority.
Well, then let's come back to the Latino vote for a moment, right, as it's being talked about in Florida and in Arizona. Put that in the context of what you're telling us about the media and how we talk about white voters.
Latino is a term that's worth sort of us taking apart and exploring in greater detail, but it is a pan-ethnic term that doesn't work in quite the same way that white does for electoral purposes. The Latinos in Maricopa County who might end up turning Arizona Democratic have different, you know, familial countries of origin than the Latinos in Miami-Dade County in Florida who shifted towards Trump in this election. The Cubans and Venezuelan in Florida are outliers among Latino voters who trend strongly Democratic overall across the country. Meanwhile, you know, white non-Republicans in the electorate, they are the outliers, which is why, you know, Democrats rely so much on strong turnout from voters of color to be viable in presidential elections. But it's important that, you know, we think about the ways that there are many, many white Latinos. And because whiteness so thoroughly informs voting behavior, we should probably be asking better questions about Latino voters, like whether they identify as white or not. That might be more illuminating than simply whether someone refers to themselves as Latino in some ways.
The backdrop to all of this, Gene, is the white vote is shrinking every year, right, in terms of its portion of the electorate. What does that mean going forward?
So starting in the very next election, it looks like these younger, browner cohorts, the Gen Zers and the millennials, are going to outpace boomers in terms of voters in the electorate. These are demographics that are much more hostile to the GOP. This is going to be a really big challenge for the GOP in terms of electoral viability in some ways. And people have been saying this for a long time, but the sort of demographic realities become really, really concrete in the next two cycles.
That's Gene Denby of NPR's Code Switch podcast. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Audie.
When you don't vote, you can't sit on a jury. You have no right to complain about the police because you won't even go and vote so you can even sit on a jury. As I've told, said to the cows when I first started to call in, I spent 11 years on a job where I worked for a bank and had to sit in court day after day, after day, after day. And I watched them select juries. I watched black people going to jail, black people having white probation officers, and the whole judicial system just truncated with white supremacy. And a great deal of it is could be lessened if black people simply voted.
Moving on now, of course, with our one-hour election special, and over the next few weeks, maybe even months, maybe even years, the data from this election will be broken down bit by bit. For now, the breakdown of all that data isn't going to be the full picture, though, but there is early data. We saw, obviously, exit polling from yesterday, certainly first impressions, too, how the voting went, who showed up at the polls, how people are feeling today. To parse through those questions, I'm joined now by Mindy Romero. She's the founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy, CID, part of the USC School of Public Policy. Mindy, how are you?
I'm awake.
Yes, you are, as we all are. Joe Matthews, my old friend, California columnist, innovation editor over at Zocalo Public Square. He's also with us. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Steve. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. Joe, I'll start with you. Can you believe that we made it through Election Day, but here we are, the post-mortem, and we're still sort of in this inconclusive territory. Tell me, how are you feeling today?
I feel very, very Californian, even more than normal. maybe a little less American, a little bit puzzled, and sort of, you know, California can be a tough place to live when you have to get on a road or you try to find the money to pay your rent or your mortgage. It's a big number. But, you know, going through this election, it was like a little ray of light. It's a place that is clearly committed to everyone possible voting, making it easy to vote, counting my vote, and this year making it fun. I mean, I ended up wandering around to all these, you know, cultural institutions and sports facilities that have been closed all year. Visited the Holloway Bowl and got my first up close glimpse at the Sophie Football Stadium, and I ended up voting in Dodger Stadium on Saturday. It's the first time I've been in Dodger Stadium all year because of this election. I'm actually still feeling pretty good and glad to be living here and maybe not in Pennsylvania.
Mindy, you're a Californian. do you
yep.
feel the same
Born
way?
And raised.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. You know, I'm grateful. Certainly, I agree with the idea that we try to expand access to voting. We've had a number of reforms in the last, you know, several election cycles to do that. I think we still have a ways to go in the Golden State in terms of making sure that we vote at high numbers. Traditionally, we have some of the lowest turnout in the nation, or at least bottom, you know, 20%. And we have a lot of disparity in our turnout rates, which will repeat themselves again, no matter how high the turnout is, you know, in the end, in 2020. So I'm excited to see high turnout. I'm, you know, puzzled by, you know, to some degree, some of the things we've seen across the country. But we also knew that this could happen. We knew we could be, you know, election day number two, and the results not only be stretched out, but certainly will be disputed. So, you know, I think it's maybe what we expect, if not what we want to see from our democracy in terms of, you know, where we could be and need to be eventually.
Well, where we're going to be, at least in Wisconsin and Michigan, is in court. Because the Trump campaign is asking for a recount in Wisconsin. We'll pay the $3 million to do that. The same for Michigan, the Trump campaign wanting to go in and make sure that they have access to the remaining votes that are being counted in the Great Lakes state. So there is that happening right now. More locally, Mindy, you have a way to zoom in on how votes were cast in individual neighborhoods, right? Even clusters of blocks or precincts. Tell us about that data and what early trends that you can take away from it so far.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a tool that you can go on our website, cid.usc.edu, and locate it. It's for LA County specifically. It's a partnership with the Secretary of State, so they graciously have been providing us data the last couple of days by the hour. And we have been tracking over the last few weeks the total vote count for LA by not only LA County, by precinct, neighborhood, essentially, right, of residents, of voter residents, and but also by vote center. And the idea is to hopefully help aid the registrar's office in terms of how they're staffing, right, and understand capacity and, you know, where more people are going to use vote centers, maybe shifting around staff or resources, but also to help aid everybody else, you know, voter advocacy groups, nonpartisan groups that are trying to increase participation. They can and have been using the tool, my understanding is, to you know, to see where, you know, where are the neighborhoods that haven't been turning out as high. So we've been hearing really high turnout across the country, across the state, just record early vote, blowing the doors off of anything we've seen in terms of an early vote previously. Same thing in LA County, but right now if you go to the tool, right, next day, votes are still being counted, of course. But we can see, and we've seen all along, but even now, after Election Day, that there are communities that are substantially below the current turnout average for LA County, for the state. There are neighborhoods that are, right now we're at a, I think 63% for registered voter turnout for LA County. And there are communities, precincts that are at 20%, 30%, 40%.
Yeah. It's disappointing.
And those are the lessons learned, right?
Yeah.
And it means that when we talk about the story of turnout this election, whatever exactly it ends up being, we need to be aware, when we talk about the power of the electorate making the decisions not only for the state, but because LA, of course, is a big part of the state's total vote count. But when we talk about local races in LA County, you know, this is another reminder, right? It's historically consistent, but a reminder that there are, you know, whole communities, swaths of LA County that are underrepresented. And, of course, these are communities that are more of color and more low-income communities, communities like South Park and Florence and Watts. And Westmont and Southgate and Compton and Paramount and Bell Gardens. And so it means we have, you know, more work to do.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to ask you a question, Mindy, because, you know, when you talk about these areas that are minority areas, it's not a voter suppression effort, right? There's not, it's mm-hmm. not, they're not hindering you from going to the polls. So what is it? What makes for a 20%, 30%, 40% turnout if people aren't going to vote? Do people feel detached from the country? Like what they do doesn't really matter? What's the psychology there?
Yeah, there's a lot of things in play. So first off, when we say voter suppression, there's lots of ways to define that, right? There's the overt that we think about when somebody's, you know, physically, right, restraining communities or doing things like poll taxes and literacy tests. And then there's more subtle forms of
voter suppression, where we discourage communities from participating, when we don't reach out to communities to participate. Campaigns and candidates are much more, much less likely to reach out to communities of color and low-income communities, even voters within them that are registered, because they're not seen as likely voters and not seen as, like, good investments for resources. Of course, there's lots of exceptions in L.A. County and lots of local community groups that are doing amazing work to get out, you know, voice and representation, but often they're kind of fighting an uphill battle against that likely voter model and the, where the bulk of resources are often going for campaigns. And this is across, you know, across the state, across the nation.
Yeah.
And yes, historically, you know, that's nothing to dismiss. So if you're in a community that historically has been marginalized, where you haven't seen where government, right, where you're represented within local or state or national government, and maybe you've even, you know, overtly been marginalized, you wonder why you may care very deeply about your community. Often these communities, there's a lot of engagement happening, civic engagement, as they define it, right, helping their community be better. But they, you know, transitioning to voting and seeing voting as an actionable step on helping their community, that's a case that has to be made, and you're fighting a lot of different factors. And including, by the way our electoral system is set up, it often the rules around it disproportionately disadvantage and have for a very long time communities of color and low-income communities, although we are making progress here in California.
Joe Matthews, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Obviously, we've got people who feel disenfranchised, if not physically so, but in, as Mindy mentioned, in many ways, psychologically and physically. Do you think California, I mean, as far as California goes, you said, oh, we made it fun, you know, I was able to put it in the Dropbox or in the mail or do it at the voting center up to 10 days before the election. I mean, does California have still a ways to go to make sure that access to voting is available to everyone?
I think it's definitely true. I agree with everything Mindy said. I think there's a sense in voting and in so many ways that in this election, today's Californians, particularly maybe today's younger Californians, more diverse generation of Californians, are actually sort of fighting uphill against ghosts, whether it's the ghosts of history that make it, you know, that disenfranchise people in all the different ways that Mindy was talking about. You know, at the federal level, you know, we sort of vote against, our vote is diminished by the ghosts of James Madison and the founders, right? With an electoral college that doesn't serve us particularly well, makes our votes count less, a U.S. Senate that is stacked against us. You know, when we vote at the state level, we're voting sort of in campaigns where ghosts are deeply present. Proposition 15, where Howard Jarvis, you know, it's me change Prop 13, and sort of Howard Jarvis is the ghost of him, dead since 1986, is on the ballot. In Prop 16, which appears likely to lose, we were sort of arguing with the ghosts of the 1990s and Prop 209 and the move against affirmative action. And then even here in the local level, you know, whether it's the battle over the district attorney or Measure J on the county ballot to try to move some resources away from law enforcement on the county level, you're sort of up against these ghosts of an LA where police and law enforcement were really, really dominant, even more powerful than they remain powerful today, but even more powerful than they are today. So I think there's a sense of being up against these ghosts across the ballot. And that this generation is not yet fully empowered to make its full democratic choices because it's up against ghosts.
I want to thank you both. We'll leave it at ghosts. Joe Matthews, California columnist, innovation editor over at Zocalo. Mindy Romero, the founder and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy, part of the USC School of Public Policy. Thanks to you both. Happy post-election time.
Now, let's go back to our main story, the U.S. presidential election. If you are a regular listener to the Global News podcast, you'll have heard us reporting on electoral chaos and confusion, corruption too, from countries around the world. Developing countries, that is. Countries which Western nations often regard as having a very different relationship to democracy. So let's put the boot on the other foot for a change. Larry Madowo is Kenyan. He's also the BBC's North America correspondent. And we asked him to look at the US election through African eyes. These are his thoughts.
Covering this US election as an African journalist has been a really revealing tour of American democracy. So, for instance, America has no National Electoral Commission. Each state essentially makes its own rules and some counties actually apply them differently. So America is just 10,000 different electoral jurisdictions, which means it can get pretty complicated and pretty messy. And I know a thing or two about both as a Kenyan who has covered elections across Africa. And so I've had a sense of deja vu working through this election season as a BBC correspondent. We have two elderly men running to lead a multicultural country, talk of rigging, the possibility that candidates might not accept the results if they lose. And we're almost there, right? Both candidates have essentially said that they won the election. I was in Philadelphia last week as businesses started boarding up in case there are protests after the election or there's looting. And I came back to Washington, D.C., and it seemed like every other building was getting boarded up as well. I spoke to organizers who were planning major demos if President Trump tried to steal the election. They used the word steal. But I'm now in the American South, and this is the core of President Trump's support. And some of his fans are so devoted to him, it's almost like he's a cult leader. A friend tweeted that people like Joe Biden, but they love Trump. And I've seen that at home as well. I've been watching the reaction back in Africa, and there seems to be more Biden than Trump supporters. I'm seeing a lot of Africans making fun of America as the election unravels. And the memes are hilarious, I've got to be honest. I guess you can call it Schadenfreude. Africans feel that America lectures them about democracy, yet it has its own problems. I did a documentary recently about what Americans call voter suppression, deliberately making it harder for some black, brown, and poor people to vote. I've seen a lot of African politicians try to block those who are likely to vote against them. An activist in Georgia told me such restrictions make American democracy fragile. And as an African, I felt that.
That was Larry Madowo with some food for thought.
We began our Roads to Election 2020 series back in September from the battleground state of Pennsylvania. Since then, the Keystone State has found itself at the center of a mail-in ballot deadline dispute and is facing growing unrest after the fatal police shooting of a black man, Walter Wallace Jr., in Philadelphia last week. The incident has once again put a spotlight on civil rights, which has galvanized a movement. Whether or not that movement will translate to the polls remains to be seen. But as NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker reports in Philadelphia, there is a renewed push to not let despair over the latest incident discourage voter turnout. This report is part of our ongoing series, Chasing the Dream, Poverty, Opportunity, and Justice in America.
It's been a long and difficult week in Philadelphia, the birthplace of American democracy, providing another entry into a tragic U.S. tally.
And even though all situations may not be similar, it just still feels like the same songs to a lot of people, you know? So I understand why people are hurting. I understand why people are mad.
Pastor Carl Day spent his week in Philadelphia appealing for calm, the first night on the streets with protesters and the subsequent days with congregants and city leaders.
I really think that this happened at the worst possible time. You may have some people who may say to themselves, especially in light of stuff like this, when they think that nothing's happening or people aren't really trying to make anything change, some people may feel deflated and defeated.
Pastor Carl says he's been urging members of his church and community to ignore this impulse.
And my advice to them is, you know, don't allow that to happen or overtake you. You know, still cast your vote. There are ballot questions that are important on the back of that affects us deeply.
In Philadelphia, these ballot questions include whether the city should form a police oversight committee and whether the police department should end the use of stop and frisk.
I understand their pain and their rage at a system that feels big and too slow to change.
Jamie Gaudier is a member of Philadelphia's City Council.
When people feel like they don't have power, when people feel like they're not being treated fairly, when people feel that they can be aggressed against again and again and again with no consequences, what you see is them take to the streets. That's what happens.
Do you fear that what happened with Walter Wallace Jr. may actually dissuade people from turning out?
I think, you know, it makes the election all the more crucial. I do hope that we have peace and that people feel like they can vote in peace and that they are not threatened. But But I also hope that people understand the urgency. I hope they understand the gravity of the situation locally, and that this is our opportunity for change and for a president who can speak for all of us. And I hope they understand that, that locally we need change too, and that that's on the ballot.
How do you respond to the cynicism? You know, thinking of the young person that it says, you know, we've spent all summer calling for change and change hasn't happened. And here, a week before we're asked to vote, this horrible thing happens, as we've seen it happen in other cities again and again.
I point to the things that we're voting on that relate directly to that issue. One of the biggest challenges here in Philadelphia has been our inability to hold police accountable for their actions within our communities. We're voting for a body that can create more transparency and accountability and give citizens more oversight. And then, you know, we are voting for our health. My residents are dying from coronavirus because of the ineptitude of this president. And so I think it's about talking to people around how this election will shape the way that we live, right? Or don't live moving forward.
There is reason to believe turnout in Philadelphia's Black community will be substantial.
We have had record numbers during this election cycle. Over 1.1 million people have been registered in Philadelphia, which is the greatest number beyond since 1984.
Brittany Smalls is the Pennsylvania State Coordinator at Black Voters Matter and Capacity Building Institute, a voting rights group formed to increase the power of marginalized and predominantly Black communities.
We ask for the call of the young people to be involved in this current cycle, and they're doing it. Of course, there's an increased effort amongst Black women. We still have some Black men that are not really engaged in the process, and we understand their concerns because they've been unheard for so long.
Black, young Black men were rarely the focal point of either campaigns throughout this entire process. So how could you expect the demographic of people to be excited, motivated, or even really feel compelled to want to vote when, you know, the only time we're brought up is when it comes down to talking about prison reform, because we're associated, Black men are associated with prison. And then when we start talking about the police injustices, and that's when we talk and we bring Black men up, you know. But everything else, every other agenda, every other demographic of people have been focused on, highlighted, you know, been emphasized. And young Black men are sitting here saying, okay, so you still didn't talk about this.
Tuesday's election, with results that might not be decided for days, may not bring the immediate action that people are calling for, but it does give Philadelphians a chance to vote for change in their communities. For Pastor Day, that's a start.
These are the things in which people still should get out there and put that ballot together and still cast their ballot, because otherwise you'll have politicians that can say, hey, we put the bills out there and we asked people to check yes and no. Majority of the people didn't say yes, so we felt like it wasn't needed.
Philadelphia will begin tallying mail-in and early votes, as well as Election Day votes, at 7 a.m. on Tuesday.
And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the white collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by Black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
New documents give us a closer look at the night Kyle Rittenhouse turned himself into police in Illinois. The teen is in jail, accused of killing two people during protests in Kenosha and shooting a third. As Fox 6's Aaron Maben explains, he showed a range of emotions while telling police what he says happened.
These are new images of Kyle Rittenhouse. The 17-year-old is charged with shooting three men, killing two, during the unrest in Kenosha following the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Newly released police reports revealing what happened a few hours after the shootings, when the teen turned himself in to Antioch, Illinois police. In the early morning hours of August 26, while talking with police, Rittenhouse says he ended a man's life and later stated, "I shot two white kids." Rittenhouse claimed he was hired to protect businesses in Kenosha. He said he was hit with a baseball bat and skateboard before firing his weapon. He told Antioch authorities that when he tried to speak with officers in Kenosha after the shootings, he was told to go home. At the police station, one officer saying the teen exhibited different emotions from calm to crying and vomited several times. Rittenhouse also worried about negative social media comments, but it was ultimately Rittenhouse who helped police locate the weapon he's accused of using in the shootings. Pictures show the rifle in the back of a friend's car.
State of Wisconsin versus Kyle H. Rittenhouse.
The teen remains behind bars with bail set at $2 million as authorities dig deeper into the case. In Milwaukee County, Aaron Maben, Fox 6 News.
The attorneys for Kyle Rittenhouse have said the teen acted in self-defense. He is scheduled to appear in court on December 3rd.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 7, 2020. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, views, the number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Right on. We will be here Monday. White man, white guests only. Normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, talking about the history of white violence against black people during election seasons in the U.S. That will be Monday. Actually, I think his work is referenced in case. I have to make sure that I'm not lying about that. I'll double check and share as we proceed with the broadcast. Wow. What a week. What a year. So as we were pretty much going live, I checked back with the news again, and they called it. They said President-elect Joe Biden victorious in the election. Trounce, I won't say trounce, but defeats President Trump. President Trump, they said, is furious. He's going to demand a recount in several of the states, but they did call the election right as we were about to go in, so it should be President-elect Biden. Mildly surprised. I'm mildly surprised about the results. White people generally are pretty reliable with regards to at least their election patterns, but the year of the Rona, wow. So certainly we can chat it out now that we have a conclusion. I don't think there'll be anything too wacky with recounts and all of that, but I guess if anybody thinks, you know, this is going to go to the courts and all that, and, you know, we might have a recount and might change things, I guess you can share that view too. But I think if they have announced and all that, it should be final. You know, they can wrangle and argue about that. At any rate, I think we should pay attention if white people are going to argue and wrangle about the results. I certainly don't think that will be anything to disrupt the system of white supremacy racism, but I definitely think victims should at least be mindful if white people have major disagreements about how the plantation, the business on the plantation will be conducted. So at least pay attention, see if we can learn anything through the next few, I don't know, weeks, months, however long all this lasts. Let's see. Things to share before we get to the callers. Certainly we will chat it up on the election. Let's see. the first segment that we started with, they talked about the mob violence in Italy, and they called it far-right mob violence. That's something that I've been talking about since the whole Rona situation began, that it's been unique, the white defiance and armed white resistance to wearing a mask and social distancing and all the rest of it, that's been unique to the U.S., that they haven't been doing that in other parts of the world. And then slowly there have been reports, I think Germany and a few other parts of Europe, white people, I still confined to white people, but going out and acting, we're not going to wear a mask and you're not going to push us around, that sort of thing. The report in Italy, they said that this was happening. I thought it was significant, not just the far-right component, but they said that this was organized gang members that they thought were behind this and saying the government doesn't care about us and all this. And they said it was the Camorra Mafia. I thought, wow. Now, I've never been to Italy, don't speak Italian, but Camorra, and they spell it C-A-M-O-R-R-A, Mafia. I thought, wow. I thought there's some history of the Moors, black people, conquering that part of the world for a period of time, and that being connected with Spain and all that, running of the bulls. Like, wow, Camorra, how interesting. And that's the name of your organized crime syndicate that's causing mischief here. Words being important. Moving forward, they had the segment about the white teens at Sandra Day O'Connor High School. They're on the football team, and they were terrorizing this young black child, black female. I don't have children. We talked a lot about having offspring in school and them being terrorized by the teachers and everything else. Lots of reasons to think long and hard about the academic program for your child prior to conception. That's what they have to look forward to. Even in the midst of a pandemic. Now, they said it was a gang of them on there, and, you know, we'll pull out your weave, and you're a monkey, and you're a nigger, we hate all niggers, blah, 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 and all that. Again, I thought the young lads are getting better. You know, it's just all Trump and his ilk. Once we get rid of them, you know, we won't have this problem anymore. That was one. Two, I know these are minors, as they say, and generally, unless it's some raping black male teen, generally, if it's a minor, you do get anonymity. They don't identify you publicly, right? It stuck out to me because it's so many different ways and times where white people, racists, they practice white supremacy, but somehow they are still not identified. They get anonymity. The whole book, At the Hands of Persons Unknown, Philip Dre. That is a really good book, perhaps for the book club one day. But that's the premise of the whole book. And you have fingerprints, photographs, surveillance footage. Like, it's not like this person just dropped from Saturn or something. Like, whoa, we've never seen. No, it'll be, oh, man. Seems like we got a picture of him lynching a Negro, and he's got his wallet out, and I think that's his Social Security card. Do we know who this is? No, we can't. Oh, okay. Unsolved mystery. Put that in with the rest of them. It seems to always happen that they just get protected. We got to blur their faces out, and we can't name them. And I know we called them a coon and said he was going to kill him and bring a bomb to school, but it is a minor, and, you know, we can't be identifying young people like that. Lots of reasons to talk to your children about racism. Isn't that what we talked about all year long, right? Just terrorizing people on the Zoom. It's been Jeffrey Toobin and these young racists. Like, that's what we did all year long. Brawled in the street over anything. Corn dogs, hand sanitizer, dead black person. Got on Zoom. I got to draw some penises or pull out my penis and call somebody a nigga. That was 2020. Schadenfreude, did you hear that? the segment from the BBC, they were discussing looking at the election and making fun of us. You got your quarter of kangaroos, ha ha ha, and all the rest of it. And they said a bit of schadenfreude. And I thought, ooh, that is a cow's word. That's right up there with like necrophilia and a few others that we, anachronism, quite a few that gets mentioned. I think we brought it up in the book club. I think it's German, but deriving some sort of pleasure or enjoyment from the suffering of others. Wow, to think you have people, black people on the continent, looking at the U.S. election and using that term to describe their emotions, like, wow. And on the continent where they are about as close to Rona-free as you can get, with the exception of South Africa. Like, wow, what a 2020. Continuing. Speaking of voting now, they said in the segment in Philadelphia, they said, we're doing our campaigns, voter turnout and all the rest, make sure that we get out. They said, we got black females, they're in, you know, they vote, but the black males, I don't know, it's a little bit tougher, you know, they've been ignored and nobody talks to them, so they're just not vested. That's, wait a minute. You just had 15-term Congresswoman Maxine Waters say that it would be unforgivable black males coming out to vote for Trump. And it was tons of reports like that about black males. And then they say, well, yeah, I don't know about black males in Philadelphia voting for Trump or Kanye West, Biden, or anybody else. Like, they seem pretty divested from all this. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean? They, let's see. Get my rest of notes. Okay, the segment about racism in the Navy. Now, they've had a lot of reports talking about it, not just the Navy and different components of the armed services in the U.S., talking about racism, and it's difficult, especially to kind of move up the ranks, as they were talking about, and to get somebody in the ranks, you're going to be a general, and all the rest of it. Very, very difficult. We should maybe read Colin Powell's autobiography. Anyway. They were talking about that segment, and they said that I appreciated the black person saying that it's not just implicit bias. I've had people practice racism directly, white people who don't want to work with a black person or work under a black person. I super appreciate him saying that. Black self-respect to the highest. They said, they continued from there and said that sometimes we're in a position where we have to work around racism. That segment easily could have been in Neutralizing Workplace Racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. But I said, work around racism. How does one do that? We're on the job, you know. I don't know what the scenario is. He called me a coon. We just work around it. No problem. I know. He calls me a coon every day. We just work around it. Okay. How much does the white person get paid who does your job? Oh, he makes $65,000 a year? How much do you get paid to do your job? $25,000. Wow. That seems like a substantial difference. Oh, we just work around it. That's, you know. That work around. I'm not sure what that means. Even if he had said, we have to put up with that, I said, oh, okay, I got you. But work around. Workplace racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Now, reading is more important than watching television. Say that maybe twice. Reading is more important than watching television. That's it. The segment from the St. Louis International Film Festival. I'm so bummed. I always, or I have missed the Seattle International Film Festival for many years. They always have a lot of great films, sometimes directly about racism. And I like went one time. It was great. And then I've missed it every time since. The Rona disrupted things last year. Maybe it'll come back in 2021. But I love the local film festivals if they have good projects. Test Pattern does not sound like such a project. Now I will pause. Sexual abuse is super serious. Not taking the rape test kits, testing them, that is a serious problem, something that has been reported for a long time. Nothing incorrect about addressing that problem. A lot of non-white people, males and females, are victims of sexual abuse, so that's definitely something that should be taken seriously. All of that said, the filmmaker, victim of white supremacy, Shatara Michelle Ford. I haven't seen Test Pattern, nor do I wish to see it, but this is another reason why, long list in terms of reasoning why we don't have non-white guests on the program anymore this year, perhaps permanently. This right here. And people were doing that even after I started saying, you know, we're just doing white guests only. People would still recommend and suggest, sometimes exactly, black filmmaker married to a white person. We've had such people on the program before, I think more than once, but I am not interested in hearing their views on white supremacy racism. VGQ, victims guaranteed qualified, but I believe Pamela Evan Harris, the late, she used to say, you cannot lie down with white supremacy racism and then get up and tell me that you're going to fight for black people. It just does not work that way. Who you have sexual intercourse with has a mega impact on your brain computer metaphor. To have that segment, and it was lengthy. That wasn't, you know, like a little 3 minute, oh, just give us a quick snippet about your film. Oh, okay, that's Test Pattern. Great. No. We're going to take some time and talk about this. Oh, great. Okay. So you're going to do a film. It's going to talk about sexual abuse and racism, and it features a black female as the victim, and she's with a white man. Doesn't that remind you to some degree of The Hate U Give? I know it's slightly different, but I'm ignorant, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, so that's going to be the premise, and this is not a documentary. This is just a film. That's fine. But if you're going to have that be the subject matter, and you tell me that looking over this and going back through the evidence in the archives, there's a pattern of black females, and they're in these interracial relationships, and the white fella's trying to go through it, like, well, according to the U.S. Census, which I guess they'll complete one day, to the data that they have, there are not a whole lot of white people in so-called interracial relationships with black people. That is not true. There might be some messing around in the back seat. There might be some messing around on the job, on the side. Marriage? No. There is not a whole lot of that. Either way, we've talked about that. You can look at the census data, for yourself. I was thinking what was going to pop out, what was going to be said, was the history of black females not being considered a rape victim. It's not possible for a black female to be raped. That's what I thought she was going to say. Like, if we got time to sit back and talk and put this in a historical context, as they say, oh, and you could even quote white scholars, Danielle McGuire, she's been a guest on our program, suspected racist, her book At the Dark End of the Street, talking about how the whole civil rights movement in some degree, or to some degree, was motivated by black females being raped and black people saying, we're not going to tolerate this. We're going to fight back against this. Rosa Parks even having to fight off and saying she was almost a victim to this because it's so widespread. There would at least be 30 seconds to include that if we're going to talk about racism, sexual abuse, black female with a white man, and that fraught history all the way back to the plantation. And we leave all that out. That is It's a long list, but that's another reason why. And I thought it was so peculiar that kept emphasizing she's with a British white man. I've heard that before where people talk as though it's something peculiar. This white man here is just the Dylan Roof variety, you know, the Jeffrey Toobin variety is just here in the continental U.S. that once you get abroad, you know, you get to Europe, you find the more refined Caucasian man. What? I thought Jimmy Savile lived. I thought Maryland, the state, was named after. I'm sorry. I must be totally confused. Maybe I haven't met enough British white men and women. We do have our Global Sunday Talk, though. None of those folks have told us that the white men and or white women are that cool that, you know, we should think of them as being substantially different from white men in the U.S. But I have heard that before. Victims Guarantee qualified. I will not check out test pattern. VGQ. Let's see. Cowbells. Spanish Lake, I did forget one component. Speaking of that area, because she's in St. Louis, or at least she said she was born in that area and grew up in the suburbs, which I did think was important. She said she grew up in Clayton County, in some of the suburbs around lots of white people. That is interesting because that does impact your brain computer growing up in that environment. And we had a white man on the program, 2014. He did the documentary film Spanish Lake. And it's about those suburbs and how white people deliberately kept the Negros out of their area. In fact, he talked about some of the white people. They had wonderful Christmas time carols and Christmas stories about the beautiful days, the good old days in St. Louis County and some of the suburbs, where one or two Negro families would move in and they would put up some of their Christmas decorations, you know, little reindeers on the roof and Satan Claus and all the rest of it, and Elf or three, and they would come out and use them for target practice and just fire, pow, pow, pow. That was so much fun. Woo, Christmas St. Louis. And this is in the film. I remember thinking, like, dang, so you shoot at the house, like, if you miss an elf and a bullet goes in the house, like, system of white supremacy. Let's see. Anything else you want to make sure? Oh, I can't make sure I get in my weekly propaganda against football. They had the segment, University of Washington, they had to postpone because of the Rona. I said, now, they weren't even going to have a season at first. It's November, by the way. They weren't even going to have a season. And they said, well, it's November. We're gonna see if we can start the season. I don't have offspring, but again, we already had brain damage. And Jerry Sandusky, we want to talk about sexual abuse. They got documentaries on him, too. The Rona, Jerry Sandusky, and raping white men and women, probably. Oh, yeah, raping white women. That was at Notre Dame. They had the teacher who was taking some of the black football students. She was. They were getting tutoring. And the white tutor said, oh, yeah, in addition to tutoring, you're going to have to sleep with my white daughter. Remember that one at Notre Dame? That was a few years, so you don't think this is like 20. That was like 4 or 5 years ago, not ancient history, like probably got tweeted about. So we already had all of that. And now in addition to the Rona, that I got to go out here on the field and run around and see if we can win a Pac-12 champ. Like, you have got to be joking in all kinds of ways. No reason at all to have your child playing football. Really, none of the organized sports. Like, that would be additional motivation. We got much greater priorities. Your health is way more important. That's a great way to teach priorities. And you can explain racism, white supremacy. I know playing football is fun. I know it would be great. I know playing basketball is fun. And you might have a lot of athletic aptitude. However, like I just said, well, we got the brain damage thing, and we got the Jerry Sandusky thing. Now we got the Rona, and we just keep going, and the racism. Wouldn't have my child in that. Lots of better ways where you can get exercise, activity, and we should have much, much, much greater priorities. And I thought you're supposed to be a student athlete. Like, that was the other thing that really appalled me about that segment. Like, I'm a student athlete. My number one priority, they don't say I'm an athlete student, right? That would be putting the A first if we're going to do it alphabetically. That's not what they say. They say I'm a student athlete. I don't even think the UW campus is open. I would have been to the library if it was. If that's the case, why are we even talking about playing football games? Is it that important? And if so, let's get a detailed explanation. Why is it that important to have these little black children run around on this field for us to sit at home and watch this on television when we're not complaining about the election results? Forget all of that. Anywho, the number again is 720-716-7300, decode 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I guess Spanish Lake reading is more important than watching television, but Spanish Lake might be worth checking out. Not test pattern. That even, yeah, never mind. Spanish Lake might be worth checking out, if nothing more than for the segment where the white race soldiers talk about shooting the Christmas decorations on the houses of the black people. Folks have thoughts on the election processing, all of this, and what they think is going to happen, if what, you know, things transpired as you thought, and how this relates to our efforts, our goal to replace white supremacy with justice, how folks around you are talking. That would be a good one, too, if you've been around, like, other black people, your family and other folks. You know, let us know if they are celebrating and think joy has arrived, our Mistress Day. This is Juneteenth all over again. We've been liberated from the racist. Let us know a thought on that. I forgot. It's been such a chaotic day. I don't know if it's connected.
Alrighty, I got disconnected right as I was ready to get to the phone line. As I said, lots of disruptions this year, this broadcast specifically, but lots of disruptions. I had to call in multiple times even just to get started, so that has been a theme throughout the year. Anyway, I was saying it was about the same time. I don't know if it's directly related or not, but it was about the same time that I saw they made a announcement about the election results. So it could be related to all of that, or it might be something totally else. But there was a big fireworks release right about the time that I saw they announced Biden had won. So I don't know if they had people celebrating and letting off fireworks. They would normally do that here in connection to, like, the football contest and that type of thing. So, yeah, maybe it was election related. It might have been in preparation for the Seahawks. I think they're playing tomorrow. I'm not sure. Maybe they're playing tomorrow. But it sounded very much like Seahawks games. I live not too far from the stadium. It sounded very similar, like when they have, like, the cannons and things going off when they score a touchdown or something. It was the same sound effect. It could have been maybe white people out shooting. I don't know. It's been wacky. You could put that on the list with penises on the Zoom call and everything else being reckless with fireworks. You put that on the list for 2020. It's been lots of that, but I think we had some of that here in the Seattle area as well. Now, should be back connected. If you dialed in and you have commentary to share, star 61, first few folks who dialed in, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard? No.
Greetings, Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Hey, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The segment about the Italian backlash against the possible lockdowns, I've noticed a lot of white countries, or, you know, most of the white populated countries who are having issues with this Rona, acting racist. Or acting in a way of being racist is not getting rid of the Rona. But I've also noticed some of the non-white populated countries
victims of racism as well, handling the Rona very well. You have Taiwan, who went 200 days without one coronavirus case. China yesterday only had 33 cases of coronavirus. And apparently I read an article yesterday, I think from the BBC, that the UK has had more coronavirus deaths than the whole entire continent of Africa, which you had mentioned about Africa, you know, with the exception of South Africa, not having a big Rona outbreak, you know. And, you know, you just mentioned also the unpredictability of 2020. And, you know, I remember when it first came out, you know, we noticed that Africa wasn't having coronavirus cases. And I think you had somebody on your show predicting that they're going to have it later on. And it's been like 7 months later, and Africa still hasn't been hit as hard as some of the other populated continents. So that was pretty interesting. And as far as the fireworks, there were some fireworks here out in Chicago in regards to the Joe Biden election, or the, you know, announcement of him winning. But, you know, before, you know, I say it, I am a victim of racism. I am a confused victim of racism, VGQ. I understand Joe Biden is a racist. I understand that Kamala Harris is also a confused victim of racism and has displayed black misandry as well. But and I don't suggest any black people to go out there and celebrate. You know, the Rona is still out there, and we've had, you know, record amount of cases across the country. But when I heard Donald Trump lost, I did crack a smile. Never liked the guy, even before he ran for office. I'm not a person that prefers overt racism to covert racism. I'd just rather have no racism. But I personally, my selfish self just doesn't like Donald Trump. And this is in no way Joe Biden is going to bring us any closer to replacing the system of white supremacy with justice. But selfishly, I just am glad that Donald Trump is gone. But and then lastly, too, in regards to the coronavirus, race soldier or head race soldier of Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker, is trying to shut down the bars in Illinois. Because of the fact that Illinois is spiking in cases just like every other state. But he's getting a lot of backlash from a lot of mayors in Illinois about shutting down bars. Now, you know, white people love their bars, and, you know, they're going against the mayor's orders of, you know, shutting the bars down, because there was a study saying that a lot of the coronavirus cases, most of the coronavirus cases come from, you know, bar settings. So, and what is also interesting is even Mayor Lori Lightfoot of Chicago, non-white black female, victim of racism as well, who is going against Governor Pritzker as well. So, you know, me, I agree with you, Gus. We don't have time to be drinking. We don't have time to be smoking. I hope he does shut all the bars, including the liquor stores and pot dispensaries or whatever, because, for one, we don't need to be doing that anyway. But that's all I have on me in my mind.
Wow. Sobriety would be best. That is, the talk about backlash. Like, wow. That is, I would definitely pay attention to what's happening in Illinois over that one. Like, white people get really serious about their narcotics. Like, woo. I will certainly endorse as well the sentiment. We certainly should not be celebrating, although I would be nauseous. I was nauseous when we were celebrating with Obama. Like, oof. Like, this would be even worse than that. Like, really, get it together. Yeah, we got the Rona. Nothing to celebrate, and certainly no reason to be name-calling Kamala Harris, victim of racism. Hope we don't have 4 years of that, man. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello. Hello.
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Salutations, everybody. Let me look at my notes real quick. Okay, so the first thing I wanted to comment on was racism in the Navy. So I was not in the Navy. I was in the Marines. And the Marines is a department of the Navy, but is also considered its own branch. And my job was basically to take pictures. And so my first duty station, I met a major general who was non-white, black male. And he came in and he took some pictures for what's called the command board, which shows who's who, basically, in the command. So I took his picture a couple times, and he was the only general of any sort that I've ever come across in my time in the military that was non-white, black. Moving forward, when I was went to my second duty station, our unit, which was considered combat information, which had a variety of jobs, so photographers, videographers, illustrators, et cetera. We would have to serve what's called like a detail to the commanding officer of the base. And I would say once or twice a year, he would have parties at his home on the base, with which was exclusive to generals in the Marines and maybe some admirals here and there. And at these parties, there would never be non-white generals, non-white black, non-white Hispanic, whatever you call it. So to hear that information about the exclusivity, I'm not surprised at all. It's hard for non-white black men to climb up the ranks, as far as I was last informed and seen, when they're enlisted. A lot of black men that I saw would retire if they were enlisted at master sergeant. Some of them would get to master gunnery sergeant. Not often. I never, except once. When I was in, I saw a black sergeant major, but he was made the exception because he was sergeant major of the Marine Corps. And then his last name was a Hispanic, Sergeant Major Estrada. So it's left to be questioned whether he identified himself as a black man. But, yeah, that's not a shock. It's white supremacy, so they want to be in charge. The next point I wanted to make is there's a lot of misandry and division going on with black females, especially if black females engage in social media, via Twitter, whatever. I was with a friend today who was very elated about the results, and she was like, look at everybody celebrating. This is great. Yes. And then she was like, yes, thank black women, because black men didn't do none of this. It was just us. I said, well, what are you talking about? And she was like, well, they did a poll that said 18% of black men were voting Republican. And I said, well, here's the thing. I said, it looks like a big number when you put it that way. I'm like, but our numbers in the United States as a populace isn't really that big. I said, but here's the question I have. Did they ask the black men why they were voting Republican? And I said, also, do you think their wives are going to disagree with them if they're voting Republican for what they consider valid reasons? So that means there are still black women in support of the Republican Party, but they need us to fight it. I said, because we don't have an African mindset of unity, you know, we're all thinking individualistically, which is very Eurocentric. And we all have to remember to be patient with other black people. We all have points of views that are considered valid but yet incorrect at the same time, because when you're in a corrupt system, you know, people are going to respond in a variety of ways. And we can't talk about anybody and we can't put down anybody. So, you know, I'm definitely not what's considered a pick me. I try to be balanced. But, you know, black men, you know, please try to shake this off, because either way, you know, y'all are on the, you know, the disenfranchised side of things. And there are some people that remember that period. And then, sorry about that. Okay, yeah, I just want to be succinct. I was listening to the archives, and there was a black female that had a similar question to someone else about teaching their kid about racism and something about exposing the child to Disney. I would suggest that you do not expose your child to Disney in any way, shape, or form. Years ago, before I had my child, I watched some show. I don't know what it was. And it was a young white male, and he apparently was sick with something. And he was talking to a non-white black male specifically and saying, oh, my God, I'm going to throw up. And then he threw up, and he threw up on the young black man's shoes. And instead of the young black man backing up, you know, he stood there, watched the white male throw up on his clothes and feet in what I guess you were supposed to interpret as dismay. But he was basically, at that time, this white male trash can. And then they cut to another scene. And I was like, I said, what the hell did I just see? So Disney has nothing to offer your child that's constructive. But as far as teaching about racism, you know, my limited experience as an educator, I would say, one, be very clear, especially with a 12-year-old, because they're at the point where they know they can start to analyze and use logic and also ration things in a more mature way. Say, hey, I was very confused about racism, white supremacy until my adulthood, and I'm still learning about it. I do not want you to have the same confusion I had as a teenager, a young adult, and an adult. So what I plan to do is for us to learn together about who we are as a people now and then, but we're going to go backwards. And let's learn about who we were before we came in contact with Europeans. There are flashcards that you can buy, and I think I suggested it before, that talk about Africa, different groups, different individual people in antiquity. And y'all can quiz each other, go through it, pick out who you like, you know, the most from it. And then from there, you can also maybe even come up with homeschool projects. And I thought about counterracism.com. Maybe that'll be a reference you can use, but maybe even come up with projects, art projects. Let's write poetry based on something we learned about. Maybe let's make a painting based off of something beautiful that we learned about the Yoruba people or the whoever. It doesn't matter. Like, just come up with something interactive and then start to decode the racism in certain movies if you are going to engage in Disney. And say, okay, now that we know that we are great people, we come from greatness, and we're being made to look as though we're inept and we're degraded, let's look at some of the modern-day messages that are being put out. What did you notice? How did that make you feel? You know, do the question zone thing. You know, and then as she gets older, maybe just give her essays or something like, why don't you read this or watch this and write down your analysis? What were the things in the scenes even like? Did you notice placement of people, objects? Was there a reoccurring theme? Were there certain words that were repeated? You know, ask questions and hold on. You know, just basically, you know, also try to come up with a codification of your own within, you know, the household, as far as teaching racism, some vocabulary that, you know, again, you have to use these words over and over again in order for them to become a part of your family vernacular. But I would develop that. I would say, hey, you know, again, let's read about it together. Let's do some projects together. But let's look at who we were before we were contaminated by racism and white supremacy, because, again, somebody else said it. I think a couple of people said it. We weren't at this point truly until there was an invasion of our people on the continent. And we know this, but let's go forward, analyze what we see now, and now we're both less confused and we're learning together. And then she can have a more, you know, an equilibrium of what she's seeing without getting depressed about it, because unfortunately the child is seeing that certain media is the norm. And because it's degrading her and it's being pointed out that it's degrading her, she feels like, okay, well, where do I fit in? And she just has to be able to analyze, you know, what I'm not going to fit in to the norms that's being put out by racism, white supremacy, because it's made to defeat me. But I'm recognizing these signals, these terms, and these symbols, and I'm better prepared for it. And that's all I wanted to say for now. There's an asteroid on the way. It's a while away, like 2029, but they're saying that it could boomerang around and be a problem in 2065. And I just find that interesting because we're in quite a fury right now. We're in, you know, we're really mixed up in, hold on. Oh, God. Sorry. My phone was doing something stupid. We're really in, you know, a really confusing times. There's a lot of things that isn't being said. Okay, yeah. A lot of things that isn't being said outside of the earthly system of racism, white supremacy, that I just find interesting that's not being said aloud in certain media sectors. So that's it for now. Hotep, and have a great night.
Much obliged, Irie in Louisiana. Sure, our attempted parents appreciate that feedback. We've been talking about that just a few programs previously. Some of the other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard? Can I be heard?
I heard both of you. Let's get our female caller first.
You can go first. Oh. Okay. Thank you for taking my call. Hope everyone's having the best night they can have. I saw two articles. One was, I know you've been talking a lot about black women and the death rates when giving birth, and there was another one, and what was surprising to me was she was a doctor. She was a pediatric doctor, but she had her baby, and 2 days later she died. She didn't look overweight before she had the baby. She had the baby and she died. And she was a chief resident at a hospital and this, that, and the other. But she got, according to the article, she got a condition called preeclampsia. I guess what that affects, it causes high blood pressure and affects your organs. So just saying that's what happened to her. So they don't really have her age or anything. So I don't know if it was something. It's something that, you know, I've heard of it before. Never had a baby. I've heard of it before, but I don't know if they did monitor or whatever. But unfortunately, there's another one. And something that I definitely believe would not happen to if the person was a non-white black person, especially black male. I guess in the state of Kansas, they elected a 20-year-old to the state legislature in Kansas, which seems pretty young, but I guess the minimum age is 18. But this person, his name is Aaron Coleman. That's who he is. He was a person who admitted to sending revenge porn and harassing girls online when he was younger. So he admitted to doing this before the election, and he still won. I don't know. That doesn't sound like someone I would want representing me, but in the era of the current, because he's still the current president, I guess, you know, things can be overlooked. And maybe none of those people had daughters or even sons, because I know things can happen to sons as well. We don't talk about that enough. But I don't know. And yeah, those are the main things I wanted to discuss that I saw online. Thank you.
Jeffrey Toobin. Hey, he didn't even get fired, so... Certainly, you can get elected to office. He probably did that when he was, you know, seven. It's tomfoolery, you know. We all have little silly things that we do when we're young. He's still got time to mature. We can't ruin his whole white future. Let's see. Much obliged. Other folks who we have missed. I guess retired firefighter. Thank you for your patience, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. The first subject, I was just thinking about the clip that you had on the Navy, and what I've always thought about the Navy, and I don't try to encourage anybody to join any military force, even the fire department. But if they do ask me for advice, I would say, you know, that's something that you want to do, go ahead, go for it. Always attempt to practice justice in what you're doing. But I've always thought about the Navy that it has a lot of jobs that require training into a whole lot of technology, like computers and all other kinds of sophisticated things. And with those skills that that individual would acquire is transferable in civilian life from what I've understood. I could be wrong, but from what I've understood. Therefore, I can see where there would be a lot of resistance in allowing non-white black people to obtain those skills, and let alone be able to opt out of the military, you know, after the time that they could do so and evolve that into civilian life and, you know, making a quote-unquote decent living. That was my thoughts on it when I was hearing the report. The voting, the present voting that took place. It's in my spectrum of people that I know, you know, on social media and whatnot, it's less talk about it since, you know, things are kind of like settling down than it was when the all of the exertion was about go out and vote, go out and vote, go out and vote. But, you know, once these things are settling down, I'm not hearing a whole lot. It's a little bit, but not a whole lot. And that kind of like indicates to me, at least I'm thinking in that way, that, you know, people are kind of like waiting to see on what are the results are going to be, that sort of thing. Those who are, you know, have always had that interest to engage into what I always call professional voting. DCS program had another session today. Quite interesting. The first thing that took place, which is not unusual, I would say most of the young fellas who enter into the program is not as their choice. It is someone else's choice that primarily feeds them and houses them that makes that choice for them. I would say with the younger children, let's say something like maybe 11 or under, they are more willing to go by the orders of mom or whoever is the person or persons that are stating that, yes, you are going to be in the program. But in this particular case, I'm assuming that this person was not an older teenager, but a teenager probably somewhere around early teenagers, from like 13, 14 years old, that was giving a very serious amount of resistance in the parking lot. The retired firefighter's thought process is to be as far away from that as possible. That is the business of that parent or whoever brought them out there and that child, as far as that concern. And let whoever that is to take care of that decision, make the decisions on what to do and what not to do in that parking lot, their business, as far as they're concerned. If eventually they left the area, they left the area. In the session today, we handed out more work material, worksheets. One was a schedule that was, you know, organized schedule of times and dates and what kind of chores that you're going to apply yourself to, and how you're also going to help the household where you reside at, and to write those things down, to write those, record those things down on this worksheet. There's a worksheet that asks questions. One states that where are you from? And there's no right and wrong answer. We just want the young fellas to be able to express themselves, since they're talking about themselves. They should be more willing to do so, and it would not require a whole lot of head down. You know, we work on the posture, work on their posture. We work on the idea in mind of, because we give them caps, shirts, several shirts. The uniform is dark color slacks, not shorts, black sneakers. We basically really encourage them to wear the uniform in the way that it was handed to them, in the way that we want it to be, because we want to have this feeling of togetherness amongst them. Also, on some of the other worksheets is, how will you help out at home? And that person will write that down. And also, at the same time, they would express that to the mentors and the other mentees, what career you are interested in. But the most significant thing that took place was when we were asking the question on one of the worksheets, why should anyone care? We had one young fellow that was quote-unquote very, I started to say brutally honest, but very honest about himself. And basically what he stated on this paper, and he stood up and voiced it, that no one really cares, and why should they? Why should they care about me? And basically what myself and Mr. Clark did was acknowledge him favorably on being so honest, and at the same time expressing to him our commitment to assist him in any way that we could. You have our numbers. We are available to you 24/7. And, you know, every way that we can reach out to this young fella, because that's what the program is for. There are, and we talk about it on this program a lot, there are a lot of our children, especially black males, are in desperate situations, very desperate situations. I don't have to tell a lot of people on this line on how suicide is a, unfortunately, is a consistent thing that exists amongst non-white black people, at least in this part of the world, out of black males, young black males. And that's basically what we did with that young person. And so it's somebody that we're definitely going to be focusing on and making sure that we would give our assistance and our sincerity towards those guys and this young fella, you know, and to participate into trying to develop into him a higher level of esteem for himself. And that's what the program is for. That's all I say on that. That's what the program is for. And that is the end of my report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter, and job well done. You and Mr. Clark, working with these young black people, that is a highly commendable effort. I mean, it's lots of things, and you've been doing this for years, lots of other things you could be doing with your time and energy on a Saturday. You have offspring of your own and family of your own and television of your own, so, you know, lots of other things you could be doing with your time and energy, but to hang out and to offer assistance. And that he, retired firefighter, shared earlier this year, which seems like it's about 5 years crammed into this one, but earlier this year, I believe it was, where, and I think it was just before the Rona, where he talked about a young black male, a teenager, I believe, who committed suicide. I believe it was near a train track, unless I'm botching the details. Like, that's kind of serious. Like, am I making that up? Okay, that's what I thought. Was that this year?
No. Pardon?
Was that this year?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
earlier this year. Earlier this year. And I mean, the first thing, the immediate thing that myself and Mr. Clark did when this, and I believe he is 14 years old, when he stated that no one cares, no one really cares about me, and it's not warranted that they should. You know, I'm just paraphrasing. You know, it's not warranted they should care, and. I said to myself, did he say that? You know, and yeah. So we immediately turned that honesty and gave him some recognition by being honest about his situation and how it is necessary that, first of all, you are – And when you see young people, when you see people like this, you wouldn't be able to tell because he is talkative. He seems to be. They're getting to know one another now. All of the young people, all of the boys, they're total strangers to one another 2 weeks ago. Now they're talking to one another, you know, peacefully and whatnot, and playing with one another, that sort of thing. And you know, very sociable with one another, and you would not think that he has that actually in his mindset, but he stood up and expressed that, looking you straight in the face, you know. And I'm glad he did it. So now this is something we actually can work on. work on, you know, as far as reaching out to this young fella and the other ones too. But I mean, he was, you know, willing to express this, you know, to be able to, so we can do whatever we can. And of course, getting additional assistance, you know, to work on this so we can turn around and build up his self-esteem, you know, and I mean, of course, that is one of the major, results of the global system of racism and white supremacy in itself, collective for black people, that a lot of us have a low level of self-esteem based on the global system of racism, white supremacy, and its results that come from it. So, you know, it's understandable that a 14-year-old black male child would also have that issue. And, I mean, I just have to face that I was born to do this, to have that type of focus with younger black males. I've been doing it now for, you know, pretty much, you know, at least half of my existence, more than half of my existence, actually, when it comes down to it, you know. And so the challenge is there. It's time to get to work. Time to get to work. And it also helps me because the retired firefighter is not not perfect. I put it that way. But yeah, that's the challenge.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks that we have missed totally, *61. If you have a hand up, line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. Hello, Gus, all the other callers. This is a caller from Los Angeles. And to answer your question about people's reaction to the election, I've asked about, I believe, five non-white black females who are in their 60s and above, and they are actually happy about Biden being elected. And when I ask specifically what's so good about being elected, they really didn't have a reason but just to say that as long as Trump is gone. Yeah. In regards to the Navy clip that you played, I just would like non-white black people to speak up in all different institutions. And I just want to give him credit for speaking up and just encourage everyone to do that. Going to the I guess the article, the clip about LA. I lived there my whole life, and I don't know about ghosts, I mean, dead racists, you know, doing things, but I know that living racists do things like, you know, they killed Dijon Kizzy, and that was around the corner from my apartment. Also, I mean, a few years back in 2018, Anthony Jacob Weber was killed by the same race soldiers. So I just wanted to point that out. With that, I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, caller in Los Angeles. I cannot believe the election madness and the fireworks and the Rona and everything else had me so discombobulated, I neglected to say we don't do metaphors. This here broadcast, that was one illustration of the metaphors. They said we still have ghosts, you know, that are causing mischief with the Electoral College. And I'm like, what? Ghosts? Are you serious? Are you talking about Casper? What? Like, come on, come on, come on. Like, no metaphor. And white people know how to make amendments. It can't be that a law that was made centuries ago can't be changed. I think they, what is it, amendments? They know how to change a law. So we were talking about alcohol before. Sometimes they say alcohol is illegal. And they come, we'll change it back. They know how to do that. So, really? Ghosts? That's why non-white people can't vote in Los Angeles? Halloween, yes, yes, yes. Other folks who dialed in, hand up, line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm currently in Peoria, Illinois. I think the last time I called was maybe 2015. You had a doctor on talking about smoking and tobacco and selling of cigarettes in the urban areas. And I came in and chimed in about Thomas, but yeah, it's been a while since I called, and the cows irritates me because, and I say that kiddingly, because it's changed how I think, and it's ever since I would hear Dr. Welsing on Carl Nelson, and it's rabbit hole to you, so I get angry because I didn't have to think that much. You know, until this point. So now everything is, you know, spot on. I wanted to talk about the caller earlier. He spoke about Illinois and the bars not wanting to close down. I live in Peoria, so I'm right in the middle. So I understand what he's talking about in Prisker. These white people go crazy. I mean, they are, let me take that back. They're not crazy. They're just who they are. And, you know, we got a lot of anti-mask white people around here. I never see black people acting up about the mask around here. It's all white people. I got a job out maybe 45 minutes outside, not to get on workplace racism, but this pertains to the Illinois thing. And, you know, what I observed, you know, I had this job 45 minutes outside of Peoria towards Indiana. And that's all you see is Trump 2020. You'll have your token Biden Harris signs, you know, but it's 80-20 all through the country in the cornfields and these, you know, white people got land. They have, you know, a lot of land around here. And that's all I see, and it's displayed, and I laugh. So, but I've observed over the past week, you know, it's ratcheted up, people putting their signs up, cars going down the street with big flags, you know, on the trucks, and I'm just looking at it, smiling, and, you know, on their houses now, when I'm at work, and they called it, as I come back, those signs, those Trump 2020 signs, I've noticed on four houses that I always look at, they took down their signs, the Trump 2020, it's usually American flag, Trump 2020, blue line, Blue Lives Matter, Blue Line, whatever, garbage. And now they're taking the Trump flag and putting the Confederate flag. That's one thing I've noticed as of my hour drive on the way home. And I smiled so hard because another thing, I couldn't get through on election night, and I definitely tried several times. And, you know, so I had listened to the and it was one of the good ones. And just what you guys are talking about, I wish I was there. I wish I could have got through. But that's what I'm observing here on that. I screwed up earlier. You know, I was kind of off cold when I was at work the other day. But sometimes I get like that, you know. I try to mind my own business, but somebody will say something and it just, you know, I turn around and look, you know. But I wouldn't come from a angle where I'm taking up a racial side of it, you know. Somebody say, usually everybody first say something kind of, you know, not correct. And, I, you know, the woman's, you know, talking about voting and how you, you know, people who don't, who talk, shouldn't, can't talk if they don't vote, you know, something like that. And, you know, I felt like it was directed to me because I was quiet just on my, I was doing some update OSHA training on the computer, and it's
Friday, and everybody's around, and it's like four or five people. One makes a guy who was a safety manager helping me out, and three other women in the break room. And, you know, one white guy with a red beard, you know, Amish-looking dude. And, you know, she goes, hey, if you, you know, said what I said, if you don't vote, you shouldn't say anything. I'm like, well, you know, turn around and, hey, I pay taxes, don't I? What's more important? Paying taxes or voting? You know, I mean, I don't have a right to say anything if I pay taxes. And, you know, when it comes out of money, you know, usually Caucasians will nod their head like, yeah, you're right. That is more important. So I have a right to say anything. You know, it wasn't directed real harsh, but, you know, I don't work for them like that. I was a subcontractor. I came in and, you know, so I just let her know, like, hey, shut her down right there. I just had to do it. I felt so good. And you know, that's all I had to say. Thanks.
Much obliged, good sir. Workplace Racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. It used to be a part of the compensatory call-in way back when. I will say quickly, I said it a lot this week. I tried to say it a lot really the past month or so. Maybe I should have said it more because we had a number of callers who said, man, I messed up on that one. No discussing politics in the workplace. That is so important for so many reasons. I say even with other black people. No, even, you know, man, if my mom was there, like, you know, we will have to talk about this later. Like, no discussing politics in the workplace. With a white person, if they, you know, want to say that, duly noted. That might even be one. Nothing need be said at all. Nah, totally. Black self-respect, if you want to respond, but I'm a big advocate. Unless our job entails the election or something of that sort, nothing need be said on this topic at all. All of that said, and VGQ, because I know some people are, you know, hey, I'm going to say something. VGQ. Valerie Yerger. Man, way back when we had Victims of Racism on the program, she did have a lot of great information about nicotine and chemical biological warfare against black people takes many, many forms. Those cigarettes, man. Let's see. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed. Oh, I did want to, before I nab the other folks who had hands up. He said, the cows irritates me. I did look up the verb irritate. Make someone annoyed, impatient, or angry. That is typical. Like, people don't say, like, man, the cows, like, that was just an enriching experience and improved my life and annoyed, impatient, angry. Although we should be impatient about replacing white supremacy with justice. I'll take that one. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Mo in Dallas.
Thank you, Ms. Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. Speaking to the last caller, I do understand his sentiments about how the program does invoke certain, you know, stems of emotions. To me, it's because personally, you know, when you actually understand your position in the system, you know, you understand how much power you don't have, you know, in the system. And it's kind of, you know, it's very grounding, if you will. So But also to him, I would like to just make the recommendation in his kind of racist logic practices. If he could, sometimes it is difficult not to speak. So what I would recommend is that for him to, if he has to say something, I would ask questions, you know, stay in the question lane. Like, you know, what makes you believe that people who don't vote don't have an opinion, you know, and kind of get some insight into the individual you're dealing with. A lot of times they'll volunteer information that will either inspire you to not engage or might provoke another question. And this in turn may get them to leave you alone because they don't like being questioned, especially if their answers make them uncomfortable. But it is, it's a very interesting position to be in. I kind of try to just listen and kind of react inwardly, like, you know, or even take notes. Take notes. This person doesn't believe people have an opinion if they don't do this. So, and that kind of gives you an insight to the character or caliber of people you're dealing with, especially in the workplace. But I would try my best to avoid making comments like that because it's being a black male. If you say things like just sort of like matter of fact, like when I pay taxes, what you trying to say, you know, stuff like that, they could take that as a threat, you know, especially being a subcontractor. Like you could very quickly make people uncomfortable in the workplace and you can get reported or and things like that. So, again, VGQ, but I would really recommend that he would have, a couple of just stock common questions to ask people that irritate him. Because this is a very irritating system, and what you don't want to do is create any more problems for yourself. That's all I have from you, my line.
Much obliged. Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. That can I ask really quick, the caller in Illinois, did she just make that out of the blue like statement? Was she talking to you? Like, did she have information about whether or not she voted?
No. I was nervous early when I spoke. I'll just tell you how it went down. I work in skilled trades, so I need to be out in the field. So I really come in here to do this, knock this out, you know, this OSHA training. And it was a Friday, like they were about to cook on the grill for the office people. And I was just in there to do my work. And they were all talking about the, you know, they were pretty much, you know, the room had a anti-Trump feel, but I already know the deal because driving in there, what I seen. So, come on. All right. So, I'm just doing my OSHA thing. There's a mixed guy who, you know, he's head of safety, so he's wearing that hat. And, you know, I'm just in here to do this. And I'm hired. I'm union, so whatever. I haven't, you know, I'm looking at the computer. I'm doing my thing, and they're talking behind me. And, you know, she goes, she says, hey, you know, I'm just, you know, all these people talking, they ain't voting. And I felt, you know, being a 41-year-old male breathing this planet's air, like, I kind of, the way she said it, you know. But I had talked to every, you know, the people in there previous to that because they helped me set up the computer, password. So I had spoken to everybody anyway. But I was just focused on this to get back out in the field. And when she said that, I looked at the computer, as I said, hey, pop quiz, what's more important, voting or paying taxes? You're talking, you know, in my mind I'm saying, you're thinking talking civil duties and all that, you know, what's more important? And she goes, you know, think about, you know, come on, paying taxes, right? So if I pay taxes, or if I didn't say me, I said if you person pays taxes, and they're a citizen, they don't have a right to speak, you know, about, or, you know, does a vote validate that, you know? What are we talking about here, you know? I didn't say what we're talking about here, but that's just how it came off. So it really wasn't like, you know, I was confronting her, but I was like, you know, the question came off, pop quiz. Funny how to relate, because I was, you know, that's how I interact with people, you know, white or black. I'm in a professional setting, and, you know, hey, you know, I didn't really come for that, but I just messed up because it was so good. I had to do it. I felt like I had to, and I'm like, you're off gold. You know this. But shut her down, had the white people snickering, you know. It was, you know, yeah, it felt good. It's unfortunate. It did feel good. And I'm at fault. I do. You're right, caller. You're right, off code. But I didn't lay into her, but I made everybody realize, what are you talking about? You know, kind of, that's how I came off. So.
Much obliged. I appreciate the extra detail, just for context is important, for sure. I will just say, before we pivot to other folk, workplace racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, that when we say we want to solve problems without creating new problems in a system of white supremacy, that grounding in, like, oh, man, my position, like, oh, now, if this white woman feels like, did this nigger just sass me? Have my white friends giggling at me out here in front of everyone? Like, okay, I'll remember this, coon. No problem. Like, oh, yeah, and particularly white women. I just said that. We just said that yesterday. Vindictive. Like, ooh-wee. Like, okay, I was voting for Trump, too. My week's been bad anyway. Okay, I will remember you for next week. I don't know if you have to work with her again, but frequently white people, they will, you know, get their payback against non-white people. So, yeah, that's why I say sometimes we're not trying to save face and have those, like, gotcha type moments, because, I mean, the system of white supremacy, they got you. Like, they get the bat. They get the first laugh, the last laugh, the best laugh in the system of white supremacy. So, yeah, real important to keep that in mind. He did stay in the question lane. He did ask a question, but I probably would not have even done that. But, I mean, you know, BGQ, still learning, trying to solve problems without creating new problems. Sometimes that's a big one I say all the time. Frequently, we don't need to say anything. And that one, especially because no question was asked. That's a big one. If they don't ask a question, like, woo, 99% of the time, no question has been asked, no comment needed. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up and we missed you totally, proceed.
Oh, hi. This is a victim from Canada. And I did send that a tweet with a quote from Dr. Frances Quest Welsing. One of the things that she says is, we do not realize that the massive deaths of black males constitute the genocide of black people, as it takes black males to make black babies and to ensure the black generation. So I just wanted to emphasize, you know, the quote that Dr. Frances Quest Welsing. And I also want to agree with the previous caller who said, you know, regarding the work situation, and that sometimes it's better if someone is speaking to you and it's like they're trying to egg you on to try to get you to say something, it's probably the best not to say anything. So I just wanted to second on what Gus said and the other caller said, because sometimes what happens in a work situation, when you have suspected white supremacists, they pick fights with black people on the job so that they can lose their job. And it's just a question. It's just a matter of them just picking fights because they can't. because we're living in a system of white supremacy racism. And as Mr. Fowler likes to say, that we are prisoners of war. So we're not equal with that white woman. And you're not equal with that white woman because she's white. She has more power. So, you know, next time if you see her and she brings up a conversation, if you think answering her won't cause a problem, you know, maybe you can have pre-thought of sentences to say to her. You know, just have something to say in advance in case she tries to pick a fight, because a lot of these white people, they want to have control and they enjoy mistreating non-white people. So they might try to put you into a trap, and that again can cause you to lose your job, because I've been there and it's really rough. So always stay in the question lane. No matter how much time they come at you, stay in the question lane. That's it. Thank you.
Much obliged, victim of racism in Canada. Indeed. Workplace racism, very important. Having a code, sticking to it, and making adjustments as need be. And that is an important point. White people, they will try to manipulate us into those little arguments and things because they know they have more power. They're going to win. Let's see. Other folks, if we missed you totally, proceed.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
I didn't. Nobody came on for a sec, so and you guys are right, you know. It was just a setup to where I wasn't going to see this woman again. I'm under contract, and it was said so light, but I do understand. You just came and try it. But this woman, I won't see this woman again. I'm out in the field. I just had to do something in the office, but you guys are right. I had one more that you always say, racist man, racist woman, racist child. And I really have one I went through in eighth grade. I always wanted to kill the cow to tell, but I'll just give you the one I seen that was kind of ironic. I was watching Get Your Popcorn Ready, a T.O. podcast with him and Chris Long, that episode with Chris Long, Howie Long's son. And T.O. was talking about a situation his first year. He came back home. I don't know if he's in Georgia. I think where he lives, a small town in Georgia or Alabama. I'm sorry, one of those two. And it was a small town, and maybe, you know, I mean, Peoria, probably have Peoria that he was talking about. And he said he went to a bar, and he felt like, you know, hey, in the NFL, come back home. I'm down at a local bar, everybody eating, you know. He said around 5, 6 o'clock, I think he said, and, you know, he wanted to be noticed, and I understood that. You know, I can understand being that young and being in the NFL and having money come back to your small town. And he was the name of the town. Everybody knew who he was at this point now, playing for the 49ers and Jerry Rice. So he was just like, hey, you know, I'm in the bar, and a guy sees me. He has a little kid, 5 years old. Little kid, the guy's kind of looking at him. He's like, hey, you know, walk up to him. Hey, T.O., hey, son, talking to his son. He's like, hey, you know, T.O., he said, read all his stats out, played college, his whole bio to his son. He said his son was about 5 or 6. But T.O.'s been there. He come from our town, and he played in high school here, and then he went here and played at college, and he went to the NFL, and he read off. And the little boy said, T.O. said, the little boy looked at him and looked at his dad. He said, what, this nigger here? And T.O. was so shocked. He didn't know what to do. He was stunned. And I found that interesting because it just resorted back to a memory I had and, you know, just what I would hear you say over the years. I don't put it out of there. I don't put a child any less than an adult when it comes out of that. So. They know. But I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you. I guess we'll get Mr. Steele first.
Awesome. Howdy doody, everybody. It's Ken Steele, and I'm reporting in from Van Nuys, California. It was a beautiful day today. Wow. If you hear anybody say anything about how black men didn't vote for the right person, or how black men, it was problematic that an increased number of black males voted for Donald Trump or whatever, point out to anybody making that observation that the current president of the United States, Donald Trump, got an increased number of votes amongst all demographics except for white males. So anybody who could say anything about black males increased voting for Donald Trump being problematic, you'd have to point to every demographic except for white males. I just think that that's an interesting fact about the voting turnout that very few people seem to be talking about. It seems that Donald Trump picked up an increased share of the vote amongst all demographics except for white males. I don't know why that is. I suspect that that percentage of white males, I think it was a 4% decrease in the share of white males. I think that decrease represents the white males who, or some of the white people who are in charge and who said that they wanted a better liked racist to be at the at the helm of the United States. So I'm really disappointed when I hear people saying or attempting to pivot this everything that's transpired into another occasion to denigrate the image of black men or black males in society. So I just want to say that, yeah, it was a wonderful day. I'm glad to be listening in and calling into the cows. And I'm glad to be here. And thanks for the broadcast.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. I heard that everything is so, you know, new, like it's difficult, but I thought that I did see one report where they said he got an uptick of white women voters specifically, and wow, I didn't hear anything about that at all. Like, really?
White women, there was increases in white women, Latino women, Latino men, black women, men, except white males. That was the only demographic that he seems to have lost. And I suspected that they were embarrassed. That represents just the number that were embarrassed somehow by everything that transpired. And I think it was all everything that transpired in the last 9 months or so.
Rona victims, a lot of things. Woof. Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Let's see, Thomas in New York, thank you for your L.A. to New York, across the country.
Good evening, Gus. I'm shocked you did a show tonight. No, it's no more system of white supremacy because Trump has seemingly lost the election. It's all over. We could go home. It's no more... Nothing we should complain about anymore. And how fast did Kamala Harris go to the first woman of color from before Tuesday when she was the first black woman. I said, wow, they didn't waste any time. Man, Africa, hardly no coronavirus cases, I heard. I guess Africa, known for their cleanliness, hygiene, and excellent health facilities, don't have any. How many of the billion-plus Africans can turn on a water faucet and wash their hands several times a day with antibacterial soap and wear surgical masks all the time? I wonder why Africa and other extremely poor countries without an economy didn't seem to get a lot of coronavirus cases, especially since a very strong, developed, emerging economy in South Africa got so many. In fact, 20,000 deaths, according to their statistics, in South Africa, and you don't have more than 14,000 cases in Botswana right next to them, or in Namibia, or Mozambique, and that's cases in general. It's just interesting. And why, Gus, do you use the metaphor, the continent, when you describe Africa? A further commentary on, I personally like Donald Trump. I thought he was the best president we ever had, at least in my lifetime, based off of my metrics. Unless someone watches and reads the mainstream media to get their opinions and talk. Policies benefited black people. The domestic policy in the United States my entire lifetime and before then has been far-right conservatism. Doesn't matter what they are. His domestic policy was not as conservative as the traditional liberals, conservative, and moderates that generally hold that office. And I thought his foreign policy, that's the metric I use, was dynamic. But the mainstream media since 2015, I never seen them just against one person, even Fox. The traditional conservative media was against him. And black people listened to it and internalized the propaganda. They didn't do their own research, and now we got Joe Biden. I guess the mainstream media hasn't been our biggest enemy and obstacle in this country historically as black people. In fact, without the media, I don't think they could run this system effectively. So what comes with the results of this election, I'm just going to look at black people like, okay. Information I've gotten about this election, well, it will be highly contested, possibly recounted in key states like Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, Nevada, and Michigan. We get two things to look forward to, that I look forward to, and they come every 4 years, the election and the Olympics. So I watch this intently. Well, since I was a very small kid, and every 4 years, you know, and I never saw so many abnormalities and abnormalities. And this is including 2000. The media's not reporting what county clerks are saying, attorney generals of states are saying. That's not Democratic. It's very abnormal. And they dismiss these things as fake news automatically, like on the news, like, wow, Twitter is blocking the president's tweets. I mean, I never saw anything like this. I said, man, I just don't know what to say. I can't conceptualize Trump pulling 12% of the black vote, the highest percentage in Republican polls since the 50s, and over 30% of the Latin vote, and losing the election when that's the Democratic base. Obama needed 94% to 95% of the black vote. Hillary got 88% and lost and blamed black people. He gets 12% of the black vote, so that means Biden got 88% and wins in a landslide, it looks like. Just doesn't add up. So I expect this to go to the courts. And once it goes to the federal appeal courts and the Supreme Courts, superior courts. He picked 300 judges. He picked 3 Supreme Court justices. I think that things might change. I'm not sure. I don't have a lot of optimism, but from what I'm reading, that's what I'm seeing. All the boarding up the cities that you played a clip for this right-wing violence, when I haven't seen any. The boarding up buildings for the event that Trump won, I don't think that's why they did it. I think it was the opposite. In Philadelphia, you're boarding up buildings because Trump won when he was winning like 90% of the vote there. Like, that makes no sense. So all the rioting and looting and violent protests I've seen this year came from the left wing and the progressive wings of the Democratic Party, not from the right wing. As for Carl Rittenhouse, I watched the video several times. I didn't see him shooting at any black people. I saw him shooting at white people. And I didn't see that as an act of white supremacy. I mean, but maybe he was there. I saw several black people around him during several times of the video and talking to him and calling him names, but I don't know. I had something to say about the book, but I see the time, so I'll just wait until the book study session to read my mind. Thank you.
Have you heard?
Who's that?
This is Ken Steele.
Yes, sir. Give me 1 second. Let's see. The continent of Africa, when I say that, I mean the physical location that is designated Africa. And generally, when I say the continent, I'm trying to specify the entirety, not just one so-called country like today in this context, to make sure I'm being specific that the Rona situation throughout the continent, with the exception of South Africa, just to make sure that's what I mean when I say it specifically. Even though I think that's the same thing, like when we talked about the so-called continent of Europe, like you could walk all the way, continent of Europe, continent of Asia would all be one thing. Like, I think you could walk all the way from South Africa to China if you had enough time, right? Isn't that true?
Probably, Gus. I believe so.
Yeah. So you could call it whole one thing continent. But that's why I say it, though. Does that answer your question?
Yes. I hear several black people refer to it as the continent. They never say Africa. And I just wondered why. So I you were very clear.
Okay. I was going to, before I get Mr. Steele, the whole judge thing, do you see any scenario where we have some long drawn out courtroom, maybe even all the way up to the Supreme Court, wrangling about the final results of all this?
Oh, from what I'm seeing, Gus, man, absolutely. Some of this fraudulent that, I mean, I could send you things, but from what I'm seeing, absolutely. And mind you, you know, I go through all media, so this is coming from the Trump supportive media. But the people that's talking are very highly qualified people that's saying something's happening. But I didn't want to, you know, come on here and, you know, come up with that because y'all would call it a conspiracy, you know. So I'll just wait for it to unfold and see if it happens. But either way, I didn't vote, so I had no dog, metaphor, I had no dog in the race, Gus. It doesn't matter, but I was upset a little, you know.
Right on. Betsy, no count, black male right there. We had a bunch of them on the program the election night, no count black males who didn't even vote. Before I get to Mr. Steele, is anybody we missed totally? Anybody that had a hand up that didn't get to share at all? Got everybody. All right, Mr. Steele. Well, he already shared. I'll get you as well, victim in Canada. Mr. Steele.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say real quick,
Yes, there is a lot of chatter on so-called alternative media, so-called Trump media, that there will be this will be contested, and there will be arguments about this, and there may be some arguments post here and there in states or jurisdictions spotted around. However, if you recall, when John Kerry lost in 2004, Democrats were saying making very similar comments about election totals and expectations. So I think that a lot of what you're hearing is the result of over-exuberant Trump supporters being very disappointed by the election results, as reported. Multiple world leaders have already congratulated Joe Biden on his victory, and the media, for the most part, has agreed that Joe Biden will be the next president of the United States, regardless if you voted for him or not. And yeah, that's that. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line.
We shall see. Let's see. Oh, that's for sure. What he just reported is accurate. We'll see if they go quietly, if we have lots of squabbling and bickering until the end of January. Let's see. A victim in Canada?
Thank you, Gus. I wanted to ask Mr. Steele a question.
Your question?
Oh, does Mr. Steele have any legal experience with employment law?
I have had a few successful, or I've had a few situations that have worked out in my favor. I'll say it like that.
Oh, because I did have a situation where I was fired last year, and they didn't pay me any severance pay, and they did a lot of illegal things, like according to their laws, like don't assault someone on the job, don't rip people off from their pay. And I realize that I am in a system of white supremacy, but I'm still supposed to try to produce justice for myself. So I was wondering if there's any information that you could give to me.
Okay, so I would say this: the longer you wait, the less chance you have with any sort of success in bringing up any of these grievances. Generally speaking, you have around 2 years at least in California. I don't know what it is in your jurisdiction, but in California, you have 2 years to file complaints relating to any sort of employee-employer relationship that took place. So I would gather up any information that I had pertaining to the situations that warrant investigation, and I would prepare a statement to give to any and all people that practice employment law in your jurisdiction. So if you're in Chicago, for instance, look up employment lawyers or employee law on Google, and then you should come up with a list of people to start dialing down. And so once you start calling these numbers, they'll have intake specialists typically, or with smaller practices, it'll be the practicing attorney themselves that picks up the call. They'll hear your case. They'll hear what you have to say. And if it is any good, or if they can work with it, they'll usually take your case on a contingency basis. That is, you don't pay anything. They get paid out of your settlement or whatever is the result of your case. Make sure you have some documentation. And if you don't have documentation, even writing down your memory of the incidences can help, because there is a discovery process that takes case. If it sounds like you do have a case, they'll go through a discovery process. You can even uncover information that you didn't know. In some of the situations that I was in, I was able to find emails that were sent about me that I had no idea that were being sent. I only had an inkling that these things were being discussed, but they were being discussed in explicit terms. So you can definitely go through that route. And also, you may want to file something, a statement with the EEOC as well. But you can also just go ahead and go to your local employment attorney offices and just call around and keep calling until somebody thinks that they can do something with your case. And then if you have a number of people who – a number of attorneys or offices that are interested, then you can go ahead and select which one makes you feel the most comfortable.
Okay, thank you. But what does the EEOC mean?
Oh, in the United States, there is, I think it's the Equal Employment Opportunity Act, and I think the EEOC is the Equal Employment Opportunity Committee. I don't know exactly what that stands for, but that's the office that goes ahead and investigates any sort of claims that violate that act, and there are certain protected classes, age, race, sex, and if violations fall within those categories, then they can go ahead and determine if there is a merit to your case, and that just strengthens your ability to come to a favorable resolution with the employer that you have a dispute with.
Would you have that? Like, I'm in Canada, so I was wondering what would be the equivalent.
Okay. Well, I don't know what the EEOC equivalent is in Canada, but you can go ahead and just type EEOC equivalent in Canada into Google, and after a few clicks, you should be able to find something that should point you in the right direction. I don't think that the process in Canada would be too different. And in fact, I think that there may be even some more employee protections that you're afforded in Canada. So things like the two-year time limit for civil liability for employers that exist here in California may not exist in Canada. So there may be situations like that, and especially if you can find some way to make your situation into a sexual harassment, kind of weave that in there, that might that might work into your favor, because those situations are taken very seriously, and organizations don't want that associated with them in a public format, like a court proceeding or even a filing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Steele.
We will pause there since we are right a bit over our 3-hour point. But workplace racism every Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Much obliged for the helpful suggestions, Mr. Steele. We've had B in Toronto, Kizzy's cousin, a number of folks from around the world participate in workplace neutralizing workplace racism, and they often do have a lot of the same type of protections or laws and things in different parts of the world. The logic is pretty similar in what you would follow. Not surprised to hear sexual harassment might work out better than trying to accuse someone of practicing racism, white supremacy. If you drop me an email, I could pass along Mr. Steele's email if you have any other questions to ask. our victim in Canada. If you have anything else you would like to ask about pursuing legal matters.
Thank you very much, Gus. Thank you very much, Gus. Sorry.
Do what we can.
Sorry for talking over you, sir.
No apologies. Do what we can. That will wrap us for the broadcast. Hope it was constructive. We'll, as we process everything, we'll, I'm sure, be able to chat more next week and all the rest. In fact, we'll be here Monday. Forgot all that. Paul Ortiz, I say he's a white guy, but we'll do the same thing like when we had Patricia Sias on the program a couple days back. He is referenced in CASED that Thomas in New York was going to talk about. He is referenced there, and he's written about election violence in Florida. So that'll be Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I say he's white, but I'll post a website so you can check out his picture, right, and come to your own opinion. And, yeah, we'll ask on Monday and be ready to roll. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Paul Ortiz, context of white supremacy. Let's see. Yes, we'll call it a broadcast. Thank you to all the folks who tuned in. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Stay safe out there. Like, wow. I told you they were doing fireworks right as we went live on the air. Maybe it was related. We got Biden supporters out here. Progressive Seattle, as they say. I don't know. Stay safe. Stay sober. If they close the bar down in your area, great. If they don't, you don't need to be there. I saw that today. I went to the grocery store, and they had, Seattle has lots of coffee shops and the local pubs, breweries and such. And they had one right next, when I went to the grocery store, they had one of the local pubs right like a block or so right away. And they had the whole little outdoor setup, and you had to have your mask on and be, you know, distance away, but you could still come, and white people could sign up and get their mug of beer and sit outside. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Not trying to save face, like, man, big one. Particularly out in public, anything with white people, we are not trying to save face. If you are still on the plantation, there is no face to save. Replacing white supremacy with justice, that's how you save face, like, man. Anywho, in addition to being sober, I still contend, let's be in the house, hunker down, do some cooking, do some reading, do some cleaning, lots of constructive, do some plotting for 2021, lots of things that we could do as opposed to being outside and being potentially in danger. If you got to go out for something that's serious, related to your offspring or whatever, work-related, great, be alert. Anything is happening around you, get out of there immediately. We're not having any sort of verbal confrontations with a white person or a non-white person in public. We should be thinking, this person could be armed. This person could be with others who are armed. Get out of there. No need for unnecessary risks in 2020. In addition, we are sober. Trying to hunker down if we can, but if you got to go out, you're alert. You are buckled. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. We need to be vigilant, making sure there's no rowdy whites in the area. And we're trying to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. The Amber Geigers that was mentioned, or they didn't say her name, but trying to minimize contact, just the little things that we can do, not being on the cell phone, not being intoxicated, that sort of thing. Quickly, with Kyle Rittenhouse, I think we had said before, because that came up, there was some confusion. He did shoot two white people. I don't think anybody said he shot any victims. I certainly didn't, but yes, Thomas in New York, we were. He shot two white people, and I think confessed that he shot two white people. Armed, dangerous white man. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person, no name calling. Man, no name calling. In the 10 stops for a reason. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.